In Search of Identity by Hassan Rashid. First chapter. Title, Prologue. The harshest of environments have some of the richest displays of life. For example, an intertidal zone found on the rocks at the coast is one. It is an area that can't be claimed by land or sea, for the orbit of the moon dictates when the rocks are exposed to the air and when they are submerged in a salty sea. The only predictable things are the crashing waves and the solid rocks, yet a plethora of creatures call this home. It is as if the unpredictability and harshness of this environment captured a certain type of richness in the creative powers that be. There are intercultural zones in human societies as well. These are unpopular zones, because people tend to need to belong to a particular group to form an identity. It is easier to say that I am Greek or Egyptian than to say I am Greek-Egyptian. People get confused as to where you stand on issues and if there were a war between Greece and Egypt, which side you would choose. These situations are not common, but once in a while it does occur that a Greek finds himself part of the landscape in Egypt. New chapter. Title, Introduction. By popular demand, this book is one of a historical novel based on world events centering on the Ottoman Empire from 1822 to 1899 and the life story of my great-grandfather Demetris Penzaris, also known as Ahmed Rashid and Ahmed Pasha Rashid. It has taken the better part of 12 years to complete, which included the travel to Egypt and Greece to verify his life's account and setting up a website, www.rashid.us/pasha. Soliciting information on his origins and family tree. I started out with only a skeleton of the Egyptian side of the story, and with the help of family members and the website, I was able to contact the Greek side and develop the story further. It is hoped that this book will fall into the hands of those who can shed further light on his remarkable rags-to-riches story. One of the startling discoveries of my research was the way in which slaves were treated and used during that time period in the Middle East in comparison to those in the USA. Being historical, this book relies on the memories and opinions of historians and others interested in history. Being a novel, it relies on my imagination to fill in the gaps. New chapter, title, Curtain Rises. As they say, the time was right when the stars were aligned in favor of Osman's dream of an empire to call his own. It was at the time the Byzantine Empire was waning, leaving a void in which Osman's ambitions were to bear fruit for 600 years. This Ottoman Empire generated a shift in power from a singular Christian European society in Anatolia to one of Islamic influence that lasted from 1299 to 1923 AD. It spread from the present-day Turkey to Budapest to the northwest, the Persian Gulf in the Far East, to Algiers in North Africa, to the present-day Yemen in the Arabian Peninsula, and Somalia in East Africa. Center stage to our story is Egypt, which was not ruled by one person per se, but by an Ottoman governor, appointed by the Ottoman Sultan Selim III, who had to contend with a multitude of feudal lords called the Mamaliks for power. This arrangement did not bid well for Egypt, because in 1798, the French, led by Napoleon Bonaparte, who was unable to defeat France's archenemy, Britain, by land or by sea, decided to attack the underbelly of the Ottomans by taking the French fleet carrying his armed forces to invade Egypt. By doing so, he hoped to cut off Britain's overland link to the rest of its empire to the east. The feuding Egyptian Mamaliks, who were not lacking in courage, took on the French separately, and were defeated one by one until Cairo fell to the French on July 25, 1798, after the bloody Battle of Imbaba. Meanwhile, the British had been trying to intercept Napoleon's armada of ships in the Mediterranean Sea. One week after Cairo fell to the French, the British fleet, at its helm Lord Nelson, discovered the French fleet anchored in the Bay of Aboukir, east of the city of Alexandria, and sank it. The Ottoman Sultan ordered armies from all over his empire to Egypt to expel the French. Feeling cut off from France, and with an impending confrontation with the Ottoman Empire's forces, Napoleon decided to invade Syria, but his forces there were decimated by the plague. He returned to Paris in a small boat, leaving the command of the remaining French troops to his successors, who were either killed off or surrendered in 1801. Many of the Turkish troops that were called upon to defend Egypt didn't return to their home countries after the campaign against Napoleon. Top clergymen from the Al-Azhar University in Cairo, the center of Arabic literature and Islamic learning, were not satisfied with these recent events, the ever-feuding Mamluks and the increased presence of the Ottomans. They decided to seek a united Egypt free from outside influence. They needed a strong leader who could take over, restore law, and order, finding him among the Ottoman forces that did not leave Egypt. He was Muhammad Ali, an ambitious Albanian army commander who had similar aspirations for Egypt. By the time the French left Egypt, the Mamluks were weakened but not destroyed, and the Ottoman forces clashed with them for power. During this period of anarchy, Muhammad Ali used his loyal Albanian troops to work with both sides, gaining power and prestige for himself. The local populace grew weary of the power struggle, and in 1801, he allied himself with the popular Egyptian Arab political leader Umar Makram and the Sheikh of Al-Azhar University. During the infighting between the Ottomans and the Mamluks, between 1801 and 1805, Muhammad Ali carefully acted to gain the support of the general public. In 1805, a group of prominent Egyptians, led by the class of educated Muslim legal scholars, demanded the replacement of the governor, Ahmad Khurshid Pasha, by Muhammad Ali, and the Ottomans yielded. Sultan Selim III did not oppose Muhammad Ali's ascension to the status of Pasha. By appearing as the champion of the people, Muhammad Ali Pasha was able to forestall popular opposition until he had consolidated his power. The Mamluks had controlled Egypt for more than 600 years. Their influence was strong and still posed the greatest threat to Muhammad Ali Pasha, whose approach was to eliminate the Mamluks' leadership, then move against their rank and file. Muhammad Ali Pasha invited all the Mamluk leaders to a celebration at the Salah el-Din Citadel, a medieval Islamic fortification in Cairo, Egypt, in honor of his son Tusun, who was to lead a military expedition into Arabia. The Mamluks were not told they were on the menu. However, when the event was held on March 1, 1811, Muhammad Ali Pasha's troops surrounded them and killed them all, except four who escaped, two of whom were Murad Bey and El-Kashif Bey. Murad Bey is reported to have jumped over the walls of the citadel on horseback. Muhammad Ali Pasha then dispatched his army throughout Egypt to rout the remainder of the Mamluk forces. Muhammad Ali Pasha proceeded to transform Egypt into a regional power, which he saw as the natural successor to the decaying Ottoman Empire. In what is now known as Turkey, Sultan Selim III attempted to modernize the Ottoman Empire along European lines to ensure its survival. He faced stiff local opposition, however, from an entrenched clergy and military apparatus, so he was deposed and killed. Muhammad Ali Pasha, too, recognized the need to modernize and establish a powerful European-style state. Muhammad Ali Pasha's first task was to secure a revenue stream for Egypt. To accomplish this, he taxed to the limit all the land of Egypt that included every donkey, date tree, and chicken. He then required all producers to sell their goods to the state at state-dictated prices. The state in turn resold the goods to the public, to foreign markets, and retaining any surpluses. He didn't hesitate to use a forced labor system to build canals and other irrigation projects to increase production and in turn profits of the state. Muhammad Ali Pasha also built an industrial base for Egypt, primarily an effort to build a modern military. Consequently, he focused on weapons production such as muskets and cannons. He built a shipyard in Alexandria and began construction of a navy. He established a textile industry too, in an effort to compete with European industries and produce greater revenues for Egypt. While it was not successful, the entire endeavor employed tens of thousands of Egyptians. Additionally, he set out to train a professional military under the title of Al-Nizam Al-Gadid, or the New Order. He sent promising Egyptians to Europe to study European languages, primarily French, so they could in turn translate military manuals into Arabic. He then used both educated Egyptians and imported European experts to establish schools and hospitals in Egypt. The European education also provided talented Egyptians with a means of social mobility. However, he depended on conscription to fill the ranks of the military, which was hated by the peasants. Agriculture in Egypt at that time was a family affair, and any time one family member was taken away, they suffered. In addition to conscription, there was forced labor to man all the new projects. These activities were so hated that the peasants would cut off their trigger finger or poke one eye out to avoid being taken away. Muhammad Ali Pasha's training program was instrumental in the establishment of a professional and efficient central bureaucracy, an essential prerequisite for the success of his other reforms. In the process of destroying the Mamluks, he had to fill the governmental roles that the Mamluks had previously filled. He kept all central authority for himself, partitioned Egypt into 10 provinces, responsible for collecting taxes, maintaining order, and installed his sons in most key positions. His reforms also offer Egyptians opportunities beyond agriculture. Though Muhammad Ali Pasha's chief aim was to carve out a personal empire, he waged war initially on behalf of the Ottoman Sultan, Mahmud II. His first military campaign was an expedition into the Arabian Peninsula. The holy cities of Mecca and Medina had been captured by the House of Saud. This Ottoman-Saudi war resulted in the capture of the Hejaz region by the Ottoman Empire in 1803. But the success of this campaign was short-lived, and with the main Ottoman army tied up in Europe, Mahmud II turned to Muhammad Ali Pasha again to recapture the Arabian territories. Muhammad Ali Pasha in turn appointed his son, Tusun Pasha, to lead a military expedition in 1811 and 1812 that succeeded in recapturing the Hejaz. But the power of the Saudis was not broken. They continued to harass Ottoman and Egyptian forces from the central Najd region of the Arabian Peninsula. Muhammad Ali Pasha then dispatched another of his sons, Ibrahim Pasha, at the head of another army, and after a 2-year campaign, the Saudis were crushed and most of the Saudi family was captured. The family leader, Abdullah ibn Saud, was sent to Istanbul and executed. Muhammad Ali Pasha next turned his attention to the Sudan, which he viewed as a valuable territory. The Sudan at the time had no real central authority and used primitive weaponry in its tribal infighting. In 1820, Muhammad Ali Pasha dispatched an army of 5,000 troops commanded by his third son, Ismail Pasha and Abedin Bey, to subjugate it to his authority. His troops made headway into Sudan in 1821, but met with fierce resistance by the Shaygia. The superiority of the Egyptian troops and firearms ensured the defeat of the Shaygia and the subsequent conquest of the Sudan. While Muhammad Ali Pasha was expanding his authority into Africa, the Ottoman Empire was being challenged by ethnic rebellions in its European territories. The rebellion in the Greek provinces of the Ottoman Empire began on March 25, 1821. The Ottomans had taken a low profile with regards to the 5th largest Greek island, Chios, during their rule, and left the governing body of the island to the Greek islanders, which included tax collecting. The only visible sign of the Ottomans was a small and inconspicuous Turkish garrison. Through the island's mainstay of mastic gum, Chios was able to make a substantial contribution through its trade to the imperial treasury of the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman government regarded it as one of its most valuable provinces and a jewel in the Ottoman Empire's turban. The island's leaders were reluctant to join the push for Greek independence, fearing the loss of their security and prosperity. But in the dead of night, in March of 1822, 18 armed Greeks from the neighboring island of Samos landed on Chios, proclaiming to be Greek revolutionary liberators of the island. They attacked the Turkish garrison, and the island's leadership was put on the spot, at which point they decided to join the struggle. In response, the Ottoman Sultan, Mahmud II, successor to Selim III, sent a fleet of 6 warships, 26 frigates, and a few passenger vessels carrying a large contingent of armed forces to Chios under the command of Captain Pasha Kara Ali. They were spotted by the islanders on March 30th. The fleet dropped anchor in the harbor of Chios City that day. The armed forces disembarked, spreading throughout the island's many towns and villages. New chapter. Title: Wrath of the Sultan. In the village of Vervarato, Dimitris Panzaris, who was 6 years old, played husband and wife with his sister, Ekaterini, who was 1 year younger. They were in the small courtyard of their home as their mother looked on while she folded the laundry. Dimitris was wearing his father's house slippers, sitting on a rocking chair with a straw in his mouth, pretending to be smoking a pipe. Ekaterini was tinkering with the spinning wheel, trying to make it go around and around like her mother does when she is spinning yarn. An old woman with a cane, dressed in a garb of printed flowers, a black scarf over her head, and a tattoo on her wrinkled chin of what looks like a teardrop, appears at the courtyard gate. She greets the mother and offers to tell the boy's fortune. "Can't you see I am busy, old woman?" yells Ekaterini's mother to the gypsy. "I'll wait," returns the gypsy, as she sat on the damp ground outside, next to the stone pillar of the entrance. The sun was shining quite brilliantly that morning, giving the mother a rejuvenated feeling, and when she was done with her chores, she went outside to the gypsy and asked her if she would like to have something to eat. They all settled down for the morning meal, with the mother in the rocking chair and the gypsy next to her on the ground, while the children sat on a bench on the other side of their mother. As the sun reached the highest point in the sky, the mother asked the gypsy, "Whose fortune do you want to tell first?" The gypsy pointed with her gnarled finger at Ekaterini and said, "Come, her little girl, and sit in front of me so I can tell you your destiny." The mother motions for Ekaterini to sit in front of the gypsy, who took out a small bag that was tied with string from her satchel, opened it, and laid it on the ground. The bag contained a host of items in it, including what looked like chicken bones, twigs, stones, shells, and seeds. The gypsy placed these items in her outstretched hands. "Blow on them," then she let them drop to the ground. She looks at the items and pointed to a long chicken bone lying flat next to three beans. "You are going to have a long life and have three children," she said. She then points to a shiny stone and says, "Your first husband will not be your husband, but a man who will make you happy and wealthy beyond your greatest dreams." The gypsy then swiped her hand across the ground, picked up the scattered items, turns to Demetris, gives him the same instructions she gave his sister, and so he did. Again she points to the long chicken bone that again laid flat on the ground with a wooden twig lying across it and said, "You will have a long and prosperous life. You will have countless progeny." She then points to three stones laying in a row and said, "You will travel wide and far from this place and speak many languages." She then turns over a shell and finds a bean under it, "And you will be betrayed by a brother, but always protected," said the gypsy. Later on that week, their father, Pentalis Pazaris, was outside shearing the fleece off their lamb. Ali, when a group of armed men with swords and muskets appeared on the road below the house. One of armed men spotted Ekaterini's father and started to point at him. Ekaterini's father put down the lamb and yelled, "Run, Maria, run!" Just then a shot rang out, hitting him in the back. The armed men climbed up from the road towards him. One takes out his sword and stabs him in the chest, yelling, "Die, you ungrateful bastard!" Maria saw what was happening through the open front door and, with panic in her eyes, locked it with the wooden board leaning next to the front window. As fast as she could, she grabbed Demetris and Ekaterini from the waist, shoving them firmly under her arms, and started to run through the back door, around the mastic tree grove, then headed toward the village of Daphnonis, to the north, where here Uncle lived by following a goat path that very few outsiders knew about. Once in a while she would look back to the house, but all she could see is smoke bellowing up from it in the distance. Her two-mile escape route was rocky and full of thorny bushes that grabbed at her dress. She had to take frequent breaks to quiet the kids down, when her heart started to pound harder or when her legs could not go any further. Demetris repeatedly asked to be put down while she was running, but she knew that if she did, they would never make it. As they approached the village, she noticed that there was no activity in the cobblestone ways and alleys, and as they got closer, they could see bodies scattered about. She backed up and sat down under a bush with tears in her eyes. Her attention then turned to the mountains to the west. Her husband told her that there was a cave up there where she thought they could find refuge until the Turks left the island, but she also realized that they could not stay there for long without food and water. With Demetris in one hand and Ekaterini in the other, she crept to the first house on her path and opened the front door slowly. The house was in shambles, with broken furniture and possessions scattered throughout. In the kitchen, she collected pieces of bread from the floor and a goat-skin wine bag in a corner, which she would use to fill with water from the water well near the center of the village. As she approached the water well with her two kids, a Turkish soldier on horseback appeared from inside one of the houses, drawing his sword, quickly positioned himself between her and the water well. He pointed the sword towards Demetris, and in broken Greek said, "Give him to me, and I will spare you and your daughter's life." "Never," she yelled back, started to run away, but the Turk outmaneuvered her and picks up Ekaterini from the nap of her dress, yanking her away from her mother's hand, saying, "Give him to me, or I will kill her." She screamed, "No!" Let go of Demetris to grab onto Ekaterini in an effort to pull her away, but she stumbled and fell to the ground. The horseman quickly dropped Ekaterini on top of her, grabbed Demetris from her arm, swung him onto the saddle, galloped away as Demetris, with outstretched arms and tear-filled eyes, yelled for his mother. New chapter. Title: Rashid Aga Mutrabi. It took most of half a day to reach the port of Chios, where the ship Amar el Nabi was anchored. It was a three-masted vessel with two rows of 15 guns each along its side. The horsemen climbed the narrow wood-planked bridge to the main deck, dismounted and delivered the boy to the ship's purser, who was logging in the booty of the raid in the Sultan's inventory book. "What is your name?" asked the purser of Demetris in broken Greek, but Demetris was still crying to hear him, so the purser caught his attention with a firm slap across his face and asked him for his name once again. It was dusk by then, and Demetris was taken down another set of wooden planks to the dark cargo hold. His cries were softer now, more of a whine from exhaustion as they passed livestock, then miscellaneous farming implements and several church bells. He was told to lie down on a pile of straw in the middle of a group of people he later found out had been prisoners, legs shackled to a post, given a piece of bread and a cup of water. The heavy shackles were too big, so he easily slipped out of them when no one was looking, crawled to a dark corner where he could hide. It was in that dark corner that he realized he was apart from his family and was on his own. He hoped to see them once again, imagined himself in his home's courtyard playing with Ekaterini, and soon fell asleep. The creaking of the ship's timbers, the snoring of the rest of the prisoners, and his need to relieve himself awoke him. It was pitch black, except for scattered columns of moon rays coming from cracks in the timbers above. Afraid to venture far, he did his duty in the corner where he had slept, then looked about for another spot to hide. His ears told his eyes to look in the direction of the sound of a sobbing woman. He sat there staring in that direction till he could see a veiled figure about 15 feet or so away. He hesitated at first, then took a chance and crawled over to her. She was alarmed to feel his touch, but then realized he was a child, grabbed him and pulled him closer as she wiped the tears from her eyes. "What are you doing out of your shackles?" she whispers. Demetris shrugged his shoulders, not knowing what she meant. "What is your name?" she asked, and he told her in a proud voice, "Demetris Pinzaris." She yanked on his sleeve and said, "Shush, speak softly or you will be found out. Do you understand?" He nodded his head in the affirmative. "What village are you from?" And he shrugged his shoulders once again. He spent the rest of the night in her arms, listening to her heartbeats, and fell asleep. 3 hours later, daylight replaced the moonbeams that filtered down. He was awakened by her gentle shake, told to return to his spot and to put his shackles back on. Demetris did so, sat there quietly, and looked to her for further instructions. The sound of snoring gradually abated and was replaced by the sounds of goats and horses as they stirred about. Activity also increased above on deck, announcing the start of another day. The creaking of the ship's timbers started to increase as it made its way out of the harbor. Once out to sea, the ship also rolled and swayed from side to side and end to end. After about an hour, the sounds of a few people throwing up could be heard, adding to the smell of feces and urine that permeated those closed quarters. Soon afterward, the cargo hold cover was removed that allowed a gush of fresh air to rush down into the cargo hold, allowing Demetris to breathe in more easily. Two men walked down the wooden plank that was leaning against the opening and approached the prisoners. The stocky one with the white turbine was holding chain shackles, and the second with the red tarbush yelled out in Greek, "Only 10-year-old males and younger, raise your hands." Demetrius was afraid to raise his hands, and so he crouched. "No harm will come to you," said the first man with the turbine. Gradually a few hands went up. Demetrius felt more comfortable and raised his. The man with the red tarbush started to signal to the one with the turbine, which boys to bring forward. There were 5 boys in all that were selected, chained together by the neck and escorted up to the main deck. They were told to stand in a line side by side next to the railing. A few minutes later, a man with a green cap who looked like an officer climbed down several sets of stairs from the command bridge at the rear of the ship, accompanied by the Sultan's purser, whom Demetrius remembered seeing the day before, logging him into the manifest. As they approached the group of boys, the officer said, "So these are all we were able to bring in," in a language Demetrius did not understand. "These are the best they could find," said the purser. The officer looked up and down the row of boys, then stopped in front of Demetrius with wrinkled shirt that was sticking out of his pants, and said as he pointed to him, "Is this one the youngest?" "Yes, Your Excellency," said the purser, who then yanked Demetrius out from the line. "He will make a fine cabin boy." "What is the price for him?" asked the officer, and the purser replied, "Only 350 kuris." "That's outrageous," replied the officer, who then said, "I'll give you 100 kuris, and that is my final offer for such a sickly-looking boy. The Sultan will be very angry if I let him go for less than 150 kuris," pleaded the purser. "Very well. Draw up my ownership papers for 150 kuris, and deliver them to my cabin by noon." "Yes, Your Excellency," replied the purser as he motioned to the man with the white turbine to free Demetrius. The officer then motioned for Demetrius to follow the officer as he proceeded to the rear of the ship once again and climbed up a stairway to the doorway of his quarters. With 2 sentries standing on each side, he opened the door and stepped in. Demetrius followed him and stood in the entryway as the door closed. Not knowing what to do, he squatted down as the officer sat down on his bed. The officer's bed was to the right. A huge set of windows were straight ahead, and to the left of Demetrius was what looked like closets and bookshelves. In the middle of the room was a large table with several armed chairs around it. The officer took off his turbine, then got up, walked to the left side of the room, and placed it in one of the cabinets. He then looked at Demetrius and said in fluent Greek, "This is where my turbine goes when I am not wearing it. Can you remember that?" Demetrius responds with nods of his head. "Can you speak?" asked the officer, and Demetrius nods again. "Then speak to me, and don't nod your head like that," responded the officer. But Demetrius was timid with fear and felt he was in trouble. The officer sensed that Demetrius was troubled, walked over to him, and told him to stand up. Demetrius stood up with elbows up in the air and hands guarding his face and head from what he imagined to be a slap coming his way, as he had had experience before. The officer took his right hand, clasped the right hand of Demetrius, shaking it in a light manner, and said, "I am Rashid Aga Mutrabi." "What is your name?"
"Dimitri Pinzaris," replied the boy in a barely audible whisper as he looked at the floor shuffling his feet. It turned out that Rashid Aga... New chapter. Title: Ahmed Aga Kawalali. Demetrius and Rashid Aga got along well after their first awkward encounter. It turned out that Rashid Aga had a Greek mother, and being half Greek melted away some of the fears and hesitations Demetrius had for him. Rashid Aga was also the captain of the ship they were on, and Demetrius felt secure from the others on board with authority over him. The captain ordered bedding for Demetrius that was placed next to the captain's bed. They dined together every night with and without the other officers at the captain's table. Now that he was somewhat secure from the random events around him, he realized he was independent with no bonds to anyone. From the point he was grabbed away from his mother, he was alone. It was a strange feeling, and at the same time frightening. It was explained to Demetrius that he was now a slave to follow the every wish of his master, the captain. The only restriction given to Demetrius was that he was to stay in the captain's room, not leave it for any reason until they left the ship together, and that was for his own protection. Otherwise, they had a pleasant relationship, more of a big brother to younger sibling. The captain allowed Demetris to climb on his lap when he was examining and marking up maps at the table. "Is this Chios?" would exclaim Demetris, pointing to a landmass on a map. When Demetris would miss his family, the captain would pick him up and just hold him to make him feel secure and loved. Demetris was destined to be owned by another master named Ahmed Aga Kawalali, the son of Hassan Aga Kawalali. Ahmed Aga, as he was known, had two wives, Alsit Hawa, who was the sister of Muhammad Ali Pasha, ruler of Egypt, and who had died a year earlier. Alsit Hawa had a daughter, Salima. The second wife was Alsit Khadija, known as Khadija Hanim, who had a son, Hassan Shaban. Ahmed Aga was also the governor of the principal seaport of Kavala in eastern Macedonia and the capital of the Kavala regional. The captain told Demetris that the word Aga was a title that meant an officer in the service to the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire. He also explained that his ship is part of a fleet of ships that protected the Sultan's territories in the eastern Mediterranean Sea. When Demetris asked the captain when they will be in Kavala, Captain Rashid Aga said that he did not know. "It is up to the commander of the fleet, Captain Pasha Kara Ali," he said. Demetris spent many hours looking out the giant windows in the captain's room. He could see some of the other ships in the fleet sailing not too close by, but close enough to recognize the Empire's flag waving in the wind from their masts. He wondered where his island of Chios was, and whether he could see it when landmasses appeared on the horizon. He wondered how his family was doing, for he did not see his father killed outside the courtyard of their home. Was Ekaterini playing in the courtyard, or was his mother spinning yarn from the wool taken from the sheep by his father, and that he helped take care of? He seemed to have gradually forgotten the ordeal his family went through as the days passed by on the ship. After 6 days and 7 nights at sea, Demetris could see a large landmass on the horizon one morning. As they got closer, he asked the captain if they were close to Chios, but the captain told him that the ship will be docking at the port of Istanbul, where most of the cargo will be transferred to shore and fresh provisions brought on board. The ship spent 3 days and 3 nights in Istanbul. The captain left young Demetris alone in his room and took leave on shore for a day to attend a meeting with the Captain Pasha Kara Ali, the commander of the fleet. "You are in luck, Demetris. We are headed next for the port of Kavala," said the captain when he returned that night with a satchel in his hand. This news was bitter to swallow, however. Demetris was gaining fondness for the kind Captain Rashid Aga. There was no other person besides his father or mother he would rather be with than the captain. "But I don't want to go to Kavala," said Demetris as tears welled up in his eyes, for he knew he would be given away, and no amount of assurance by the captain appeased the young one. The captain took him in his arms and told him it would be all right. "You will see. Look, Demetris, I brought you a new set of clothes to wear when we disembark at Kavala." He then took out of the satchel a pair of black shoes, black pants, black jacket, a white shirt, and a black cap. "Here, put them on and let me see how you look." Captain Rashid Aga was indeed pleased when Demetris took off his clothes, shoes, and put on the new ones. There was one problem, however. The shoes were a little too big, and so the captain fashioned stuffing from rags off of Demetris's old shirt. It took 2 tries to get the rags in the right position to prevent them from dragging as Demetris walked around in the room. It took another week to reach the port city of Kavala. Meanwhile, Demetris had to take off the new clothes before going to bed in the evening so that they would not get too wrinkled. On the third morning while docked in Kavala, Captain Rashid Aga and Demetris had breakfast, then disembarked the ship and started to climb the streets of the city by foot, for the city was built on the side of a hill. When they reached a huge wooden doorway built into a stone wall, the captain used the butt of his walking stick to knock on a large brass plate located under the door handle. A few seconds passed before a pair of eyes appeared in a small window near the brass plate and asked who was there. "Please inform Ahmed Aga that his friend Captain Rashid Aga requests to see him," said the captain in a language foreign to Demetris's ears. The eyes in the window then looked down to Demetris and asked if he was to also attend the meeting. The captain answered in the affirmative.
Wait here, said the eyes. The captain and Demetrius waited for a long time before the door opened with creaks and a squeak. Please come in, Captain Rashid Aga, said a man dressed in a soldier's uniform. The soldier escorted the two through a lavish garden, up a stairway to the main building, and opened a large wooden door. Follow me, he said as he entered a great hall, up another set of stairs to a room with chairs and wooden crates that lined the walls. Wait here, he said as he then walked into another set of doors, and the two of them took to their seats. Soon, a man of about 55 to 60 years of age, wearing white, emerged from the same doorway, approached them, and Rashid Aga stood up. The men exchanged kisses on both cheeks. Welcome, Captain Rashid, as both shook hands. How have you been, and who is this young man accompanying you? Asked the man. I am well, thanks to Allah, and this is Demetrius Panzaris, whom I bring to you to be your son's companion, as you had wished. As it turned out. New chapter. Title: El Habashia, the Ethiopian. As it turned out, the man was Ahmed Aga, the governor of Kavala, who had requested a year earlier the captain bring him the youngest boy he could find for his grandson, Hassan Shaban, to play with, who was 8 years old at the time. Ahmed Aga was delighted with Dimitris patting him on the head, checking his teeth and clothing, then summoned the nanny by clapping his hands and yelling, Ya Habashia, O Habashia. When El Habashia entered from a spiral staircase in the far corner of the room, the governor told her to treat Demetrius as part of the household in every way and to watch over him. El Habashia was a tall, black-skinned woman whom the governor acquired from what is now known as Eritrea, as a young girl from her family who were destitute. Yes, Your Honor, she replied as she bowed, then took the boy by the hand and led him away down the staircase, yelling for Usta Ahmed to bring another cot into her room for Demetrius. El Habashia lived in Ahmed Aga's household for about 12 years. When she arrived, she knew only the Tigrinya language, and now she has learned enough Greek in Kavala to be able to converse with Demetrius. She told him Ahmed Aga was a kind and generous man, although he does not show it. For example, he has written in my name about 200 acres in a place called Minyat Ganag in Egypt. She was 8 years old when she came to the Aga household. She was encouraged to go to school to learn Greek, since half of the help spoke it. She was constantly worried they were talking about her when they spoke it, and she didn't understand. El Habashia was a religious woman of the Islamic faith like the rest of the family, and she could be seen in her room reading from the Quran every chance she got. When Demetrius asked her what she was doing, she told him, keeping the bad spirits away. She takes him in her arms and says, You see, the world is full of bad people, and we need to stay away from them. This is the Quran, and it has the power to do that. Whenever she was called upon to perform her duties and had to leave Demetrius alone, she would give him her Quran to hold, and that way he felt safe and secure until she returned again. It was placed in a green cloth bag with tassels along the bottom, a strap that Demetrius put around his neck and across his chest to keep it from touching the ground, as he was told. One day, while Demetrius was walking in the garden of the house near the front gate, a delivery arrived from the butcher, and as the doorman opened the gate, a wild, rabid dog slipped into the compound. Before the doorman could chase the dog out, it approached Demetrius, growling and barking. El Habashia heard the commotion from the ground floor window of Ahmed Aga's office, jumped out, and ran towards Demetrius. As she got within a few feet of him, the dog lunged at her, mouth open, baring his canine, chomped down on her arm, and wouldn't let go, no matter how hard she hit him with her other fist. Demetrius grabbed the tail of her galabia and started to pull her away from the dog, and all of a sudden, it was all over. The doorman had also run towards Demetrius with a hatchet in his hand and severed the dog's head. Still hanging on to El Habashia's arm, the doorman gently unclamped the dog's jaws and set her free. She was lucky that day, for her galabia was of thick lining and there was hardly a scratch on her. From that point forward, Demetrius was in awe of her. He slept where and when she slept, ate what and when she ate, and did whatever she told him to do. And new chapter. Title: Demetrius arrives in Egypt. His Highness Muhammad Ali Pasha has summoned me to Egypt to help build the Egyptian Navy for his upcoming campaign to thwart the Greek uprising on orders from the Sultan, said the governor, Ahmed Aga. And as you can see, I'm getting ready to go in a month, God willing. My family has already departed on the lead ship while I finish up handing over the city to Mustafa Aga of Crete. Where will you be stationed, Governor? Asked Rashid Aga, and the governor responded, In beautiful Alexandria. Alexandria, Egypt. It was June 3, 1822, in the middle of the Islamic month of Ramadan, when it was required of all to fast from sun up to sun down, except for the ailing, very young and very old. Fasting consisted of not taking in food of any kind or water while the sun was up. At the end of the day, and as the sun disappears from the horizon, a cannon would be fired in town to signal the time all could eat again. There are 12 Islamic months that followed the 28-day cycles of the moon. With each new moon, so did a new Islamic month start. The Islamic year is therefore shorter than the Gregorian year by 11 days. This means that each Islamic month falls in a different agricultural season of the year. For example, Ramadan may fall in the summer one year and in the winter 15 years later. As Demetrius walked down the plank hand in hand with El Habashia to the dock of the port of Alexandria, he could see a ship docked in the distance that looked like the ship that took him to Kavala. He pointed his finger at it and started to yell, Rashid! Rashid's ship is over there! But El Habashia yanked on his arm and motioned to him to be quiet, lest someone guesses he is Greek, for she was teaching him Arabic, but had not yet reached the word ship. There was a long procession of about 11 horse-drawn carriages parked alongside the ship on the dock. They walked to one of the last ones in line, climbed in, along with their packages and cases of belongings. They waited for what seemed the longest time until all the carriages were occupied or loaded with trunks, and then proceeded to roll out through the city with its tall buildings that went up two or three stories high. As the driver made clicking sounds with his mouth and occasionally yelling, Ha! The cobblestone streets yielded to dirt ones, and soon they approached a large two-story building sitting in the middle of an attractive garden with red and yellow flowers lining the path up to the main door on the first floor. There were two girls looking down on them and giggling from the second story. As Demetrius and El Habashia got down from the carriage, the two women started to yell something at them. El Habashia motioned to Demetrius to get ready to catch something, and then the two girls started to throw flowers as if in a contest, see which one could score one of the new arrivals. Gradually, Demetrius learned to go after the flowers before they hit the ground. A boy about the same height as Demetrius, but with heftier proportions, appeared at the doorway, was intently looking at Demetrius, then started to run towards him, with his head aimed at Demetrius's back, knocked him down, and attempted to take his place, but the two girls stopped throwing their gifts, yelling something at the attacking boy. El Habashia picked Demetrius up and started to brush the dirt from his behind, when the governor walked up to the other boy and told him something in a different language, then pulled him by the shoulder toward Demetrius, saying in Greek, This is my son Hassan Shaban, and from this day forth, the two of you are brothers. He then told Hassan Shaban something, and Hassan Shaban reached over and grabbed Demetrius' hand, shaking it so hard, hurting Demetrius' shoulder. Demetrius didn't know what to make of the young Hassan Shaban. He didn't know whether the vigor of the handshake was an expression of friendship from a true friend or a sarcastic foe. That night, Demetrius was taken by El Habashia from her room and escorted into Hassan Shaban's room, where there were two beds separated by a window with shutters. Hassan Shaban was already in bed looking at Demetrius intently as he got into the other bed. That first night was a long one, and after Hassan Shaban was fast asleep, Demetrius snuck out of the room, and under the light of the candle glowing in the hallway, he found El Habashia's room and snuggled to her in bed. Demetrius had learned about 100 Arabic words for the food he ate, as well as different objects in or near the bedroom, such as chair, bed, and bathroom. He started to understand some of the grammar of this new language, which was sort of turned around from the Greek way, and also learned how to pronounce the difficult letters like KH,
which sounded like someone trying to get rid of something in the upper throat, and the GH, which was like a gurgling sound. Since he was then a member of the family, he was given the Muslim first name Ahmed Abdullah and asked to select a last name. At first he wanted to keep his last name, Panzaris, but Ahmed Aga forbade it. He would have no Greek member of the family, and it had to be another name. This demand was too hard to swallow for Dimitris. He protested by stomping hard with his feet and yelled, "No, no." A long week passed by with no last name able to come forth from him. It felt like ripping apart who he was. A frightening thought, and he often sat in silence with tears dropping from his eyes while El Habashia stroked his hair. He wanted to run away and go back to Chios, but he realized that it was impossible. Finally, she decided to select the name for him. It was Rashid, after the kind captain who took care of him on the journey to Kavala, whom Dimitris mentioned frequently. With hesitation, he accepted, but he knew he really was a Dimitris Panzaris at heart. From that day forward, he was known as Ahmed Rashid. It turned out the two girls on the second story of the house throwing flowers were Hassan Shaban's sister, Salima, and her slave companion, Aziza. School was out for the summer, and Khadija Hanim, Salima, and Hassan Shaban would ride a horse-drawn carriage called the head carriage, driven by Osta Ahmed every day except Friday to Morad Beach, where there was a row of cabins around a little sandy bay. Osta Ahmed also took care of the horses and their stable. El Habashia, Aziza, and Ahmed Rashid followed in a separate carriage, driven by Osta Mohammed, who also doubled as a waiter in the big house. At the entrance to the row of cabins sat a beggar with no legs on a rag in the corner of the short stairwell, holding out his hand for anyone to give. A couple of hours before the time to eat, he would start his journey on wooden U-shaped devices that protected his hands from the rough streets and swung himself, a foot at a time, in the direction of his home. The cabin consisted of a front entrance area and a locked room behind it. Every day, El Habashia, with the help of Aziza and Ahmed Rashid, would drag the wooden chairs and couches from inside the unlocked room to the entrance area. Ahmed Rashid spent most of his time in the cabin, sitting in a corner chair with the girls, and Khadija Hanim playing Siga, a game like checkers, sung songs, looked at people coming and going on the promenade that connected all the cabins, or the girls played Al-Hagla, something like hopscotch, while Hassan Shaban built fortresses with bridges out of the sand and swam with other young boys. Passersby to the cabin included vendors of sweets who carried their goods baskets on their shoulders yelling, "Friska!" Others were fortune tellers of the kind, who would carry a small sack of stones and bones that they tossed on the ground in front of you. There were also palm and tea leaf readers. As mentioned before, the house was a two-story affair. The sleeping quarters were upstairs, while the reception rooms and offices were downstairs. On one side of the upstairs were the sleeping rooms of the boys, while on the other side were the sleeping rooms for the girls, Ahmed Aga and Khadija Hanim. Between the two sets of rooms upstairs was the living room and dining hall, which had a dumb waiter that ran up and down to the kitchen in the basement. Occasionally, when there were Nawat storms and children could not go to the cabin on the beach, they would play on the roof. Ahmed Aga was absent most of the day but was home by lunchtime. On his way home, he would stop at a bakery and get dessert. By the time he arrived at the table, all would be sitting silently waiting for him to start eating. They all also waited for him to start the conversation. He often asked how Ahmed Rashid was doing at the beach and if he found any friends. Ahmed Rashid always knew him as Mohammed, the suffragi, waiter. But in actuality, he was Osta Mohammed, the driver of the second carriage. He stood ready near the dining room door, wearing a light-colored and often white galabia, traditional dress, and a white turban with a white towel over his left shoulder looking for any movement. As Ahmed Rashid sat down, he would come and fill his water glass, and when everybody had arrived and settled down, the food was served. He usually started at the head, Ahmed Aga, Khadija Hanim, and then served the rest of us as he circled the table. He approached Ahmed Rashid from his left and leaned in with the server in his left hand as Ahmed Rashid tilted a bit to the right. Generally, Ahmed Rashid would select what he wanted, and occasionally Mohammed the suffragi would do the picking for him. When it was time for dessert, he removed the top plate and side silverware, leaving one modest set of silverware placed above the dessert plate. New chapter. Title: The Swimming Ring. One day, Usta Ahmed, the driver of the lead carriage, walked up to Ahmed Rashid and gave him a swimming flotation ring, which was a gift from Ahmed Aga. With hesitation, Ahmed Rashid accepted the ring. He already knew how to swim very well and really did not need it. When Hassan Shaban saw Ahmed Rashid with the ring, he started to laugh, saying, "Only a baby needs a ring like that." Ahmed Rashid had enough of Hassan Shaban's ridicule. He swung the ring as far as he could out in the bay, and then dived in the water and came up right in the middle of the ring. He then swam out farther than Hassan Shaban dared to, where it was over 15 feet deep. All the boys on the beach noticed Ahmed Rashid's achievement and yelled praise at him, waving their hands in the air. Even the grown-ups in other cabins were surprised at Ahmed Rashid's daring, and from that day forward he was no longer the shy little Greek boy with blue eyes, but a proud member of the community. From that day forward, Ahmed Rashid played with the other boys on the beach, and his language and social skills improved tremendously. Khadija Hanim and the kids would take excursions to town or to the circus. One excursion was to the zoo. As they passed the peacock cages, Ahmed Rashid spotted a feather sticking out of one of the pens. He stretched his leg, then his arm, hanging over the rail that separated him from those great birds, as the girls held on to him lest he fall over. After groaning and extending himself to the limit, he grabbed its tip and pulled. It was a prize of sorts, all shiny and blue, and he held it up high with pride, but Hassan Shaban had other ideas, and he snatched it from Ahmed Rashid and ran with a smile on his face. But the smile on his face didn't last long, for they were all carted away by one of the zoo caretakers to headquarters, accused of stealing the speckled feather. The zoo's director was Osama Bey, a well-known historian whose accomplishments were reviewed in the Alexandria Al-Nada newspaper frequently. He was sitting in a large brick building at a desk dressed in a suit smoking a pipe. "Why did you steal the feather?" he asked Hassan Shaban, and Hassan Shaban replied that Ahmed Rashid was the one who took it from the cage. El Habashiya spoke up, saying that it was outside the cage and lying on the ground. After much debate, the occasional threat of imprisonment, a warning was given to them, and they were released, never to do it again. New chapter. Title: The Epidemic. Ahmed Rashid at age 7. Osama Bey's death came suddenly in October, 1823. He developed a fever, headaches, weakness to the point he could not stand up on his own. He complained of shortness of breath, chest pain, coughed, and sometimes coughed up bloody mucus. This lasted for about 3 days, then he developed respiratory failure and shock before dying on the fourth day. His doctor, Sami Ezad Efendi, Esquire, guessed it was the Black Death that took his life. He ordered the body be put in a tightly woven bag, sealed immediately, and placed in a secluded room where incense was to be constantly burned until burial the next day. When the undertaker came to take the body, he smelled the incense, noticed the peculiar bag, and inquired about the cause of death. Osama's son, Ustaz Ismail, told him that his father died in his sleep of old age. "Are you kidding me? Why isn't the body dressed in white linen? No, this is not an ordinary death. Tell me the truth. What was the matter with your father?" asked the undertaker in a loud voice that caught the attention of most of the gathering crowd in the next hall. "Shush! Keep your voice down," responded the son. "How much more do you want?" "I need double the amount," said the undertaker. The doctor was right about the cause of death, which was the start of the spread of plague in Alexandria, and which was then quarantined off from the rest of the country on orders of Muhammad Ali Pasha, himself the supreme ruler of Egypt. When asked, the doctor would advise his patients not to eat chickens or birds of any kind, no fatty meats or fish, to drink water boiled with guava leaves, and to burn juniper incense all the time. Ustaz Ismail knew how to quarantine his house, not so much to keep the disease from spreading from it, but to keep it from reinfecting the house, his family, and servants. They did as Dr. Sami Ezat instructed, and in addition, no one left or entered the house until the problem was over. Food, water, and money was exchanged via a basket, that was lowered from the second story of the house down to the grounds where merchants would come selling their goods. Most of the population, however, was not that lucky. Their houses were one-story affairs built with fired or mud bricks. Often their farm animals were ushered into the house at night to keep them from being stolen. In addition, there was no sewer system in place for the vast majority, and so garbage and fecal matter often streamed down the middle of streets and walkways. She was about 5 feet tall, a black woman who always wore black. She was Osman Bey's suckling nurse, which was a common practice among the aristocrats of those days. She breastfed and raised him, his children, and young slaves. Her name was also Abbas, mother of Abbas, and she was very protective of the children. Every day she would bring her incense concoction, called bokhur, made up of twigs and an assortment of seeds. Among them were yellow and red pea-looking things, each with a black dot making them look like eyeballs. She would place them all in a metal bowl and heat it over a wood burner until the smoke started to billow out. She took that smoking can from room to room, chasing out bad entities like ghosts and spirits. She would then place the potion in the living room and have the kids jump over it several times. Spirits are the cause of bad luck, as well as disease and illness. Ustaz Ismail was suffering from chest sickness when she entered the bedroom. She lit the wood burner and placed an empty metal bowl and a piece of white rock called shaba on it. After about 10 minutes, the shaba melted, and when asked, Ustaz Ismail told her it looked like a fat blob. She asked him if he knew someone of that shape. He thought and pondered, then said, "My uncle Ism." "Oh, yes. He was the one who gave you the evil eye and made you sick," she said. "But Abbas, it can't be," he said. "Uncle Izam is away in Cairo and a dear member of the family." She asked him if he had a coin and placed it, along with Uncle Izam's effigy, in a small rag and tied it all in a bundle. Her instructions were clear. He walked out of the house into the middle of the front street, turned around, threw the bundle back over his right shoulder, and walked to the house without looking where it had landed. She explained that the person who picks up the bundle and takes the coin would attract the dreadful spirit that made him sick. She also cut out a portly doll from a piece of paper and told him to poke it several times with a pin. She then burned it, swabbed the ashes with her fingers, and wiped them on the heel of his bare left foot as a way to get rid of the depraved phantom that invaded his body. The plague eventually killed about 15,000 Alexandrians out of a population of 50,000 by the time it waned. Among the dead was Ahmed Aga's daughter Salima and his slave Dir el-Habashiyah. The death of el-Habashiyah dealt another devastating blow to Ahmed Rashid, for she was the only one he clung to for support and reassurance. Khadija Hanim realized this and tried to step into her shoes, but she was not the same to Ahmed Rashid, who one day stepped into el-Habashiyah's room, picked up her Quran, swung it around his neck and across his chest as he used to do. He felt a bit more secure. New chapter. Title: The Head of the Family. Like a morning glory being trained to climb a trellis by snipping, bending, and looping its vines, sometimes being restrained by the twists of stiff wire until they took on the proper disposition from a young age, so was Ahmed Rashid's training on how to conform and never veer from the strict code of submissive conduct while in Ahmed Aga's presence. Say hello with a high-pitched voice when greeting him. Never turn your back to him, and when approaching, greet him, sit down, and be quiet. As a result, Ahmed Rashid walked backwards to retreat from his presence. It showed respect. Ahmed Rashid did and said everything he told him to do and say in the most rigid exactness. Ahmed Aga wasn't exactly full of smiles, and with respect came fear. He was stern and commanded ultimate decision-making authority. Ahmed Rashid's fear of him crept into his dreams, where Ahmed Aga became God in one particular dream, sitting in the dark dining room on his large high-backed armchair with a crosshatch wicker seat, and Ahmed Rashid was stuck hiding underneath between the rungs of its legs, a place he should never have been. He could not breathe or move lest Ahmed Aga noticed him. Ahmed Rashid tried desperately to escape, but Ahmed Aga turned and growled in his direction, so he stayed put and trembled. His place was at the head of the table during the main meal, around 3:30 p.m., and he ate cow's hocks day after day, on which he liberally poured salt, preferring its soft tissues and rich soup, as opposed to the alternatives that required a more or less complete set of teeth. Whenever outside the house, he carried a sword in a light brown holster, clinging to his right thigh, concealed by his jacket. Ahmed Rashid saw him reholster it once after foiling a robbery downtown. On another occasion, as he was getting out of the car after returning home from the shipyards, he got alarmed by the behavior of his dog, Dib el Heesh. Thinking it was rabid, he started swinging his sword as the dog ran around in the courtyard. Gouges appeared everywhere in the walls and floor. Dib el Heesh was lucky and got to see another day. About once a week, Ahmed Aga would fire his driver, Osta Ahmed, for whatever reason, but poor Osta Ahmed would show up the next day ready for work as if nothing had happened and take him out on his daily and route inspecting the shipyards. He sat on one of those simple bow-backed wood chairs frequently seen at restaurants with an elbow on a small round marble tabletop, leaning back with his chin up in the air. He wasn't a thin man, and one thing Ahmed Rashid remembered about him was the bulge in his pants. It seemed that it was the fashion in those days to have suits tailored with the crotch riding high. It was rumored that he used to be a devil as a child, to the point that every weekend his parents used to make sure that he was cleaned inside and out by bathing and giving him castor oil, a substance that caused severe diarrhea, before he resumed boarding school the next week. As described during the birth of Islam, believers and non-believers in God were distinct and opposite. In a heated discussion one summer about who will go to heaven or hell, he entered the room and said, "There are no non-believers." "Yes, Baba Ahmed Aga," said the youngsters in the upstairs living room, and the debate was over. Apparently, at the end of the day, some non-believers in Allah would build a sculpture of their God out of sticky dates, pray to it, and when done, have it for dinner. So believers and non-believers were not starkly black and white, but two hues of gray. One hue required an object to pray to, and the other didn't, but they both needed to believe. On the door to his office is a plaque with these words, "I believe that all beings have magnetism to one another, and especially when they have something in common, and often the hurdles that separate them are smoothed over in the course of interaction. Thus, by the magnetism between beings in the presence of inconsistencies smoothed over, disregarded, and considered irrelevant by blind obedience, were no longer threats and spark one's interest." New chapter. Title, Khadija Hanim. Like Ahmed Aga, Khadija Hanim was dignified. The children were taught to bow, kiss her hand, and smile as they said, "Saida ya mama," hello mother, when they met. On the other hand, she wasn't overly feared, and the children could, for example, turn their backs to her when leaving a room and speak without having to be spoken to first. She had a great deal to do with our mannerisms. "Don't slouch, sit up straight at the dining table, always have the source of light behind me when you were reading, hold your reading material up to the level of your eyes, and never put back food after picking it up from a serving dish." She was Ahmed Aga's wife, and, as Islamic tradition has it, she kept her maiden name after marriage. She had a consistently cheerful disposition, smiling and sort of singing under her breath, and always doing something productive with her hands, such as writing in a book or a score of music, or mending a sock by slipping a wooden egg into where the hole was in the sock to preserve its curved nature. Even when she was disappointed with the children's often mischievous behavior, and a frown dripped down her face, they could tell she was pretending. She had her own private, informal sitting room, decorated with sketches and paintings of her children. She had a bed in the room, along with a mysterious cupboard with windowed, lockable doors and dark pink curtains hanging on the inside. It hid my favorite wrapped candies from exotic places, cash, a large round box filled with white powder, a good-sized fluffy applicator, jewelry, keys on chains or large rings, household accounting booklets, and much more. Ahmed Rashid accompanied her on one of her many trips. It was a small building that had a large wooden gate that opened onto a sandy courtyard. As she entered the manager's office, she asked one of the girls in the hallway to show Ahmed Rashid around. There were about 3 or 4 rooms each, with 2 girls working their hands and fingers with super speed at large wooden rug weaving assemblies. After watching for a while and trying to figure out how they did it, the girls asked him if he wanted to try. The assembly consisted of a frame and guide notches at the top and bottom, with thick strings or cords running up and down over and under the frame through the guides and towards the back. Sitting down on the bench, Ahmed Rashid had to take 2 adjacent threads of strings and lay a filament of woolen yarn over them, then loop each end of the yarn all the way around the outside of each string towards the back, then bring the 2 yarn ends together in the back, push them to the front in between the 2 strings, pull them down real hard, and cut off the extra. As soon as Khadija Hanim got up in the morning, she impatiently pulled on the cord that was nailed high to the molding of the bedroom door. It rang a bell in Osta Mohammed's quarters in the basement, who would stagger up the stairs to the 2nd floor. He in turn would have to knock on the front door, and she would let him in after unlocking the door to the bedroom's quarter in her flowery pink and white robe. He had to set up the breakfast table and brew her must-have pot of fresh coffee. Her breakfast always consisted of a selection of cheeses, sweet lemons, fruit, compote, a concoction of figs, prunes, raisins, pine nuts, other unknowns simmered for hours in a sugary solution and left to cool overnight, and 2 cups of half coffee and half milk. She would then cut a cube of cheese with her knife before eating it with a piece of dried bread. The hired help, especially the men, were never trusted and seemed to take the blame for anything that went wrong. Osta Bonduk, Chef Bonduk, was the cook who would go grocery shopping before arriving at 8 a.m. He would plead innocence to Khadija Hanim's grilling of his purchases, for she had to account for every half melim 1/12 of a penny, the count and size of every egg, the weight, age, and cuts of meat. New chapter. Title: The Dumb Waiter Incident. Pest, went Hassan Shaban to Ahmed Rashid as they sat in the upper sitting room playing checkers. What? Asked Ahmed Rashid as he was contemplating his next move. Do you want to disappear and become invisible? Asked Shaban. Ahmed Rashid's head popped up from concentrating on the checkerboard, his eyes wide open, and said, Yes. Hassan Shaban took little Ahmed Rashid by the hand to the dumb waiter, opened the door and whispered, Get in. Ahmed Rashid wondered if this was another one of Hassan Shaban's tricks to get him trouble and exclaimed, This is where food comes out. I know it's also where dirty plates disappear after we eat. Ahmed Rashid got up on the chair next to the dumb waiter and climbed in it. Hassan Shaban then closed the door on Ahmed Rashid and knocked on it 3 times. It was pitch black in the dumb waiter now, and suddenly it jerked and started to make a moving sound. It must have been about a minute before the door opened on the opposite side of Ahmed Rashid, and there stood a surprised, poorly dressed, short, emaciated, and somewhat toothless cook, Osta Bonduk, in a dark room full of wood smoke. Welcome, Master Ahmed. What are you doing playing in the dumb waiter? Asked Osta Bonduk. Don't you know you can get into a lot of trouble being down here in the kitchen? Why should I get in trouble? Asked Ahmed Rashid as he climbed out and onto a table sitting next to it. This is the common area of the house, and it is off limits to special people like you. Hurry, climb back into it, and I will send you back up. Don't send me back. I'll get in trouble, said Ahmed Rashid. No one can say that, Master Ahmed, except Allah. Only He knows the future and no one else. What will happen, and so be brave. I just know that Hassan Shaban called Khadija Hanim to the dumb waiter and told her what I had done. Don't worry about that. It has already been written what will happen, and so there is nothing one can do but accept what will happen. Where is it written what will happen? Asked Ahmed Rashid. It has been written on your forehead, Master Ahmed, replied Osta Bonduk. What does that mean? Inquired Ahmed Rashid. All a person's acts during his or her lifetime are written on his or her forehead at birth by Allah, said Osta Bonduk. A person can't see what is written on his forehead, now can they? So, when they act as they see fit, which is what is written on their forehead. So climb in the dumb waiter and have courage, for it has been preordained. With hesitation, Ahmed Rashid climbed into the dumb waiter again, and Ostabanduk closed the door, then grabbed a rope hanging next to it and pulled. A minute later, the dumbwaiter stopped moving, and Ahmed Rashid pushed the door open. There was no one there, so he climbed down onto the chair next to it and snuck away before anybody saw him. New chapter. Title: Chantel's Bracelet. Off of Morad Beach is an island called the Island of Masoud, to which accomplished swimmers often swam. It happened one day that Hassan Shaban, Ibrahim, and Ahmed Rashid were swimming to it, when Ahmed Rashid saw a bracelet partially hidden among some rocks in the water's cool depths about midway to the island. Instinctively, he dove down and retrieved it, rushing to the surface, declaring his prize, only to be disappointed by Ibrahim declaring that he had saw it first, and therefore it was his. Ibrahim was a red-headed chap with freckled cheeks who was a friend of Hassan Shaban. Most of the time, he would be found playing Siga in one of the cabins on the beach. He was a likable character, and Ahmed Rashid was surprised that he would declare the bracelet his. It made no sense that he who saw the bracelet first didn't turn out to be the first one to dive after it. The bracelet had the name Chantel engraved on it, and it became an object of contention for several days after that. Hassan Shaban agreed that it was Ibrahim's bracelet, and Ahmed Rashid resisted giving it to him, despite the fact that they were older than he was. Under any other circumstances, Ahmed Rashid probably would have given it up to the elders, but something about it being so shiny and once possessed by the beautiful Chantel made him keep it despite insistent and repeated attempts of taking it away from him. For example, in the middle of one night, he found Hassan Shaban trying to take it off his wrist while he was asleep. Ahmed Rashid pretended to be asleep, yanked his hand away, and turned over. One day, Hassan Shaban cornered Ahmed Rashid in the bedroom and insisted that he give it up, repeating Ibrahim's claim that he saw it first. The pressure was mounting within Ahmed Rashid to give it up, but then he snapped. He took the bracelet off and threw it out the open window to Hassan Shan's surprise, never to be found again. New chapter. Title: The Slaughter of Nabila. On one occasion, the boys and girls of the neighborhood decided to have a war of the sexes. It started out harmless enough with pretend swords, but later escalated into throwing things at each other like sticks, then dirt clods. The girls managed to corner the boys, who then escaped to the top of the chicken cages, where they would throw stones at the girls. Then tragedy struck. Nabila, a cousin of Hassan Shaban, started to bleed profusely from her forehead and was carried away by the grown-ups as the women yelled, "They slaughtered her!" The boys were gathered together by Aunt Isan for interrogation as to who did it. Aunt Isan was the shortest of Khadija Hanim's sisters, and as all the other boys professed to be innocent, Ahmed Rashid blurted out that he was the guilty one. Well, that was it. But he escaped relatively unharmed from the incident, as Aunt Isan had to jump to slap him, and all he received were slight brushes of her fingers on his chin. Great Uncle Hamid then came up to us and decided that all the boys should be punished by taking turns at the water wheel for the rest of the day. New chapter. Title: School. The island of Masoud was a favorite place for the boys to play. It was rocky, and it had a depression in the middle where pirates hid from the authorities in pretend games. But alas, the school break was over, and school started. Ahmed Rashid was all excited about school, for he had to wear a uniform, and that conjured images of wearing military outfit or something along those lines. He was disappointed, however, that it was no such thing. It was just a gray galabia, Middle Eastern dress, with a dark blue jacket. He was the first one up on the first morning school started ready to go, but had to wait for the rest of the children to wake up. They piled into Osta Ahmed's carriage and proceeded to exit the compound on their way to school. After about 45 minutes, they reached the city center, where the carriage stopped in front of a small building where the girls, with their heads covered in white, were escorted by Osta Ahmed in through a gate covered in vegetation. About 5 minutes later, he emerged, got in the carriage, and started it rolling again. About 15 minutes later, the carriage stopped. Asta Ahmed told Hassan Shaban and Ahmed Rashid to get down and follow him in through a large iron gate that was part of a 6-foot fence surrounding the school compound. The doorman asked Asta Ahmed for the names of the children, and then let all three of them in, closing the gate behind them. Asta Ahmed escorted them into a courtyard where there were two rows of students standing in front of the Egyptian flag on a flagpole. He told them to get into the longer line and follow the instructions of the teacher at the head of the line. Then he left. As Ahmed Rashid stood there, a bell rang, and all the children in both rows saluted the flag and sang a song. He silently saluted the flag until the chorus stopped, at which point the bell rang again, and the teacher at the head of his line waved with his hand, indicating for the line to move and follow him into the classroom. There were 8 tables in the room, with 2 chairs each arranged in 2 rows facing the teacher's table. There were only 2 classes in the school. The first class, the one in which Ahmed Rashid and Hassan Shaban were in, was for learning the alphabet, reading, writing, and arithmetic. The second class was for students who graduated from the first class, and they studied and recited the Quran. Each student in the first class was handed a book of letters and numbers. He was then separated from Hassan Shaban, whom he had initially sat next to, and told to sit at the other side of the room with the beginners. Class started at 9 a.m., and there was a break at 10 a.m. for 15 minutes, where they were allowed to stretch in the courtyard. Another break occurred at 11 a.m. until 12:30 p.m. for a served lunch and play. Lunch consisted of a vegetable dish over rice in a bowl, followed by rice pudding. Finally, they got to go home at 2 p.m. after the final class that afternoon. The first class's instructor was a wire of a man with a mustache and a chipped front tooth that caused him to lisp. His name was Ustaz Mohsin, where the word Ustaz meant mister. He walked around the classroom with his hands behind him, holding a stick that tapped his back, ready to smack the table of the student who was not paying attention. Occasionally, it was used to discipline mischievous students by striking their open hands. One day, Hassan Shaban placed the nail-riddled heel of an old shoe with the nail's business end up on Ustaz Mohsin's chair before class started in the morning. Ustaz Mohsin's face grimaced as he sat down, and he stood up immediately, holding his behind. Picking up the heel and dropping it in the wastebasket, he looked around the room as he raised his stick and told the whole class to stand up, form a line in front of him, and hold out both hands. He would walk up to each student in turn and ask them, "Who did this?" And when they said they did not know, he whacked them hard on both hands. Ahmed Rashid was second to last in line, and when Ustaz Mohsin asked him the question, he answered, "I did." There were a few surprised giggles in the room, and Ustaz Mohsin yelled, "Quiet! Here we have the first honest one of you all, for you all are accomplices in this shameful act. Just for his honesty, I will spare him and all who come in line after him." The last one in line was Mustafa Alamash, the son of Alamash Bey, the governor of the city of Alexandria. Mustafa was relieved and thankful to Ahmed Rashid, becoming his best friend from that day forward. In 1824, when Ahmed Rashid was 8 years old, and after learning how to read, write, and the basic math skills of adding and subtracting, Hassan Shaban, Ahmed Rashid, and Mustafa graduated along with a few other students to the second class, where they learned about the basics or becoming a good Muslim, such as prayers, the Hajj, and reciting passages from the Quran, of which each student was required to provide a copy. By this time, a few facts crept into Ahmed Rashid's thoughts. For example, he realized that not all children were going to school, and when he asked why, he was told that leaning the letters was a privilege afforded by the upper classes, which consisted of about 5% of the population. The two classes were separated by a courtyard with 2 large fig trees. The figs were of the small and dry variety that stung when thrown at someone. Other games played under the fig trees included one where a student would get on the shoulders of their classmate, challenging other such duos, and battles would rage until only one duo survived. After eating, Ahmed Rashid used to go to the little strip of lawn at the west end of the school with his friends, where they would have fun wrestling with each other. One day, Ahmed Rashid was thinking of setting up a vegetable garden like his dad once taught him in the north end of the school compound. And as he was surveying the area with Hassan Shaban and Mustafa, he ran across a half-buried human skull. He picks it up, and immediately Hassan Shaban said he saw it first, and so it is his. But Ahmed Rashid told him to bug off. The skull had a hole in the top of its head. The boys wondered how it got there, and if that was the cause of death. Ahmed Rashid smuggled it home and placed it on a partly hidden shelf in their room. Unfortunately, he could see the skull looking at him in the light of the moon, shining through the window, and eventually it scared him, so he decided to give it a proper burial. He smuggled it back to school, and all three of them took it to where Ahmed Rashid had found it, placed coins in the eye sockets, as Usta Ahmed told him to do, put a handkerchief over it, lowered it into a deep hole while it looked up, filled the hole with sand, read the Fatiha, the first verse of the Quran, and then left it alone, returning to their lunch break activities. One day, Mustafa didn't show up at school, and when Ahmed Rashid asked his teacher, Ostaz Abdul Futu, he was informed that Mustafa's father had died the previous evening, and Mustafa was to be in the procession that takes his father to be buried. Ahmed Rashid was really upset about the situation and felt that he had to be with Mustafa on such a day, and so he schemed with Hassan Shaban on how both of them were to scale the fence to join the procession and return before Usta Ahmed came back to pick them up. During the 10 a.m. break, they snuck behind the classroom building, and since he was the smaller one of the two, Ahmed Rashid got on top of Hassan Shaban and scaled the fence. Unfortunately, Hassan Shaban was too heavy to pull himself up and over the fence and was left behind. Ahmed Rashid proceeded to walk to the heart of downtown Alexandria, went up to a carriage driver and asked him if the procession for the governor had passed yet or not. The carriage driver told him that it hadn't and asked him if wanted to ride with him. Ahmed Rashid knew that this would cost, and so he declined and walked about 100 feet up the street and stood there waiting. About an hour passed before the procession appeared on the next street over. The coffin was draped in the Egyptian flag and pulled by two horses, followed by a large group of men on foot. He ran towards the walking men and tried to spot Mustafa, but could not find him, then decided to join the mourners in their walk towards the burial grounds. He was pushed and shoved around as the procession tried to keep up with the horses, and he almost got trampled over. He then decided to run up to the front of the group, and there he found Mustafa, and immediately took his hand. Mustafa was surprised and asked him how he managed to leave school, and Ahmed Rashid told him. They held each other's hand throughout the proceedings until a carriage arrived, they hugged, and Mustafa left for home. As he approached the school, Ahmed Rashid saw that Usta Ahmed was in his carriage with Hassan Shaban, looking right, left, standing up, sitting down, and all around for him. He jumps into the carriage, and immediately Usta Ahmed pushes his head down so that no one can see. Apparently, Hassan Shaban told his teacher that Ahmed Rashid was sick in the bathroom with diarrhea whenever asked. When school was out, Ustaz Mohsin and Ustaz Abdul Fatu looked in the bathroom but could not find him. They enlisted the help of the doorman in looking for him around the grounds as Usta Ahmed started the carriage rolling down the street towards home. By the end of 1824, both Hassan Shaban and Ahmed Rashid graduated from what we can call preliminary school. They were then ready to go on to the next stage of advanced junior religious learning at Al-Azhar University, where they spent 2 years studying more of the Quran and the books of the Hadith and Sharia. New chapter. Title: The Battle of Navarino. Ahmed Rashid at age 11. As you recall, Muhammad Ali Pasha was expanding his authority in Africa when at the same time the Greeks started an uprising against the Ottomans, starting in 1821. The Ottoman army, however, proved ineffectual in its attempts to put down the revolt, as ethnic violence spread as far as Constantinople. With his own army proving ineffective, Sultan Mahmud II offered Muhammad Ali Pasha the island of Crete in exchange for his support in putting down the revolt. Muhammad Ali Pasha sent about 16,000 soldiers, 100 transports, and 63 escort vessels under command of his son, Ibrahim Pasha. The Greek rebels were no match for the well-led, disciplined Egyptian soldiers, and Ibrahim Pasha achieved a string of victories, culminating in the recapture of Athens in June of 1827. With supremacy on the ground, the Ottomans ignored Muhammad Ali Pasha's plea not to upset the Western powers of Britain, France, and Russia. The British Navy subsequently sunk the Ottoman and Egyptian ships in the unplanned Battle of Navarino in October of 1827 under the command of Admiral Edward Codrington. If the Ottoman government was not in the least prepared for this confrontation, Muhammad Ali Pasha was even less prepared for the loss of his highly competent, expensively assembled, and maintained navy. With its fleet essentially destroyed, Egypt had no way to support its forces in Greece and was forced to withdraw. Ultimately, the campaign cost Muhammad Ali Pasha his navy and yielded no tangible gains. In compensation for this loss, Muhammad Ali Pasha asked the Ottoman government for the territory of Syria. The Ottomans were indifferent to the request. The Sultan himself asked blandly what would happen if Syria was given over and Muhammad Ali Pasha later deposed. But Muhammad Ali Pasha was no longer willing to tolerate Ottoman indifference. To compensate for his and Egypt's losses, the wheels for the conquest of Syria were set in motion. Muhammad Ali Pasha desired the control of Syria, both for its strategic value and for its rich natural resources. This wasn't a sudden, vindictive decision on his part, for he had harbored this goal since his early years as Egypt's ruler. For not only had Syria abundant natural resources, it also had a thriving international trading community with well-developed markets throughout Palestine, Syria, and Iraq areas. In addition, it would be a captive market for the goods now being produced in Egypt. Yet perhaps most of all, Syria was desirable as a buffer state between Egypt and the Ottoman Sultan. Orders were given to replenish the armed forces and rebuild the Egyptian Navy's fleet. Muhammad Ali Pasha called on Ahmed Aga to help to further improve the means of agricultural production in the western area of the Nile Delta to pay for his armed forces and the upcoming expeditions into Syria. Ahmed Aga surveyed the area and decided to build a farmhouse on about 750 acres in an area called Istima to manage the project. He also bought a house in Cairo in the neighborhood of Al-Dawawin into which to move his family from Alexandria. The move to the Al-Dawawin house was completed in May 1828. One day, Ahmed Aga was approached by Mahmud Bey al-Sadi, inquiring about the marital availability of his daughter Salima, the sister of Hasan Shaban. Mahmud Bey was inquiring for his son Sami, who was an officer in the cavalry. Ahmed Aga and Mahmud Bey discussed the matter over a period of a week with their wives, and then announced the engagement of Sami and Salima. A month into the engagement, Salima called it off. The official word was that she didn't love him, but Hasan Shaban figured it was something else that caused the split. While waiting for Ahmed Aga to come to the lunch table, he whispered something into Ahmed Rashid's ear. Ahmed Rashid then walked right up to her and with a low voice said, "You can tell me why you called off the engagement. I won't tell anybody." She whispered back in his ear, "He smelled like horse sweat." By 1829, Hasan Shaban was 15 years old and wanted to be a commanding officer of a gunnery brigade, and so his father managed to get him enrolled into an officer's training school in Izna, a town in southern Egypt, called the Muhammad Ali Pasha Military Academy. Meanwhile, Ahmed Rashid traveled with Ahmed Aga to Isdima first to supervise the building of the farmhouse, and thereafter supervising the improvement of agricultural production in the West Nile Delta. The building of the farmhouse had its problems. The intention was to build it with fired bricks, but unfortunately, whenever they ran out of that hard-to-get brick, they would start using raw mud bricks to meet schedule. Every time this happened, Ahmed Aga would get furious, insisted on tearing down the mud brick walls and replacing them with fired ones. Needless to say, the project did not meet the deadline. Ahmed Aga and Ahmed Rashid had to stay in a hotel in the town of Besyun, not too far away. The reason fired brick was so hard to come by was because it required a lot of wood to burn, and Egypt was not known for its forests. After the farmhouse was built, Ahmed Aga had a steady entourage of 5 to 10 agricultural specialists at a time stay there overnight. A typical morning included breakfast at 8:30 a.m. and a working session in his office on the first floor, which had maps of the territory on the walls. The projects were managed top to down with ideas and orders generated in those morning meetings. To manage the projects, he had an accountant and a scribe to document whatever decisions and progress they made. Ahmed Rashid wasn't left out of any of these activities, but was a permanent fixture observing what was happening. Occasionally he would tell Abdu Sarur, the waiter, if someone needed a cup of coffee or something to eat. In the afternoons, Ahmed Aga would take Ahmed Rashid on his inspection of different projects around Istima. It was during these outings that Ahmed Rashid learned the most about the business of farming, from digging canals to reclaiming desert lands. Once every 2 months or so, Ahmed Aga traveled to Cairo for a month to make a report to the Ministry of Public Works on any progress he had made. New chapter. Title: A Star is Born. Ahmed Rashid at age 13. He rode a donkey behind the carriage of Ahmed Aga, and behind him would be an entourage of very young peasant boys following them everywhere. Occasionally, Ahmed Rashid would let one of them ride with him on the donkey. "Put him down right this second," would yell Ahmed Aga at Ahmed Rashid. "Didn't I tell you not to play with these people?" And Ahmed Rashid would obey. There were many stops along the way where Ahmed Aga would get out of his carriage and talk with his engineers on how they were doing with their projects and if any progress was made. The projects, for the most part, dealt with digging canals to get Nile water to lands that were dry or were in a desert area. Once water reached any given area, the soil had to be prepared for planting, which usually meant turned it over if it was muddy, and if it was desert, adding organic material to it to hold water. Ahmed Rashid took advantage of these stops and talked with the young boys who would surround him, for they had just as much to say about the projects as the engineers did, and what they said was what they heard from their fathers, uncles, and grandfathers. On one such occasion, Ahmed Rashid noticed large tracts of land that had no crops planted in them. They weren't desert lands, or short of water resources. He asked the peasant boys what was the matter with these lands, and the boys would say that they were boorish. When he asked what that meant, one boy named Al-Arabi told him crops did not grow in them. Ahmed Rashid picked up a clod of dirt from one of these boorish lands and examined it closely, for he was curious why nothing would grow in it. He found white streaks in it and wondered what they were. When he asked Al-Arabi, Al-Arabi told him poison. "Can you remove this poison, Al-Arabi?" asked Ahmed Rashid, and the answer was, "Yes." "How?" And Al-Arabi took his hand to a corner of the field and showed him a tall grass-looking plant. "If you plant this weed in boorish land and burn it every year after 3 to 4 years, you can plant crops in it." That evening, Ahmed Rashid mentioned this observation and the discussion he had with Al-Arabi to Ahmed Aga. Ahmed Aga told Ahmed Rashid not to bring such nonsense to him again and went on to say, "These peasants don't know anything. All they know to do is work hard with their backs because they have very little upstairs, if you know what I mean." Those harsh words didn't put a damper on Ahmed Rashid's thinking process. He knew that it was helpless to pursue the conversation with Ahmed Aga any further, so he set out to think about another way to solve the boorish land problem. About a month later, while watching Ahmed Aga eating, he noticed the color of the salt he was putting on the cow's hocks in his bowl and the similarities it had with the white streaks in the boorish mud clod. The next day, he went out of the farmhouse compound and asked around for Al-Arabi. "I'll get him for you, Pasha," said a boy outside the compound gate, who then ran towards the village across the road. Al-Arabi showed up about a half hour later and was greeted by Ahmed Rashid. "Can you bring me a couple of clods of dirt from a boorish plot of land?" Al-Arabi obliged him the next day with a large satchel of the mud. It was fava bean season, and so Ahmed Rashid planted a couple of seeds in the open satchel and watered them. Every day he would check on the seeds to see if they had germinated, and after 1 week of no germination, he took them out and placed the satchel in a tub of water for a day. He then took it out of the tub and placed two new fava beans in the satchel. On the fifth try, and as he was about to give up, the seeds germinated. All excited, he showed the satchel with the germinated fava beans to Ahmed Aga and explained what he had done. Ahmed Aga was impressed and gave Ahmed Rashid half an acre of boorish land to experiment with, along with two men to help him. Within a year, he was able to plant fava beans by consecutively flooding and draining the plot of land. Flooding the plot was no problem, but draining it was, and they had to dig drainage waterways to accomplish that. On Ahmed Aga's next trip to Cairo to deliver his reports to the Ministry of Public Works, he took Ahmed Rashid with him and introduced him to the minister as a boy genius who solved the problem of boorish lands. When asked, Ahmed Rashid explained what he had done. For his efforts, the minister pinned a large star on his lapel, patted him on his back, and said, "Excellent work, my son." All at the Al-Dawaween house were excited for Ahmed Rashid's accomplishment. That night, as he took his clothes off, he noticed an inscription on the star that read, "Al-Nizam al-Gadid," meaning the New Order, which was the name of the armed forces after Muhammad Ali Pasha took power. A week later, Ahmed Aga took Ahmed Rashid to the land registration office and registered the 200 acres in Minyat Ganag, once registered to El-Habashiyas in Ahmed Rashid's name. New chapter. Title: The Birthday Party. Ahmed Rashid at age 14. It was Hassan Shaban's 16th birthday, and Khadija Hanim arranged for a party at the Al-Dawaween house that included the children of who's who of high society. Among them were some of the princes and princesses of the royal family. Hassan Shaban was home on leave from his studies at the academy and was all excited about his party. As is the custom now, guests brought gifts for the occasion, but unfortunately, Ahmed Rashid was short of funds on account he spent it all on fava beans for his experiments. What to do, he asked himself. After some thought, he came up with a brilliant idea to get back at Hassan Shaban for all the mean things he had done to him over the years. First, he got a large basket like one of those they use to carry fruit and vegetables from the market. Thinking further, he then filled it with rocks from the garden so that it felt heavy and worth something. Third, he ventured outside the compound in search of the actual gift. He didn't have to wander far before finding it. It was perfectly round and mostly dry, with a fist-sized area in the middle that was still fresh. So he put the water buffalo dropping in the basket and covered it with red butcher paper from the kitchen. It turned out to be impressive-looking and heavy. He put his gift among the others on the table at the corner of the party, which was held on the roof. After all the activities and food was served, it came time to open the presents. As Hassan Shaban approached the table, he couldn't believe his eyes. There it was. The largest gift on the table was wrapped in red. He picked it up and was further impressed by its weight and guessed it must be an English saddle. So he rips at the butcher paper, and lo and behold, it was a cow's crapola. The boys laughed, and the girls made squeamish sounds covering their mouths. It was a totally embarrassing moment for Hassan Shaban in front of all the distinguished guests present. He knew immediately who it was from and took off running after Ahmed Rashid and caught him near the stairwell and pinned him to the floor. "Help!" yelled Ahmed Rashid, and soon Prince Ismail and Prince Tawfiq came to his rescue. Unfortunately, they were not strong enough to pull Hassan Shaban off of Ahmed Rashid. As they all struggled, a bumblebee flew into one of Hassan Shaban's pant legs and started to crawl up. As it got closer to his crotch, he felt it and started to scream. He then let loose of Ahmed Rashid and started to run downstairs while slapping at his crotch. When he reached his room, he took off his pants, and the bumblebee fell to the floor and was limping as it tried to get away, but not after it stung him, you know where. Khadija Hanim had just the remedy for this situation, which was a slice of onion that he had to put on his scrotum for half a day. New chapter. Title: The First Turkish-Egyptian War. Ahmed Rashid at age 15. A new fleet was built, A new army was raised, and on the 31st of October 1831, the Egyptian invasion of Syria under the command of Mohammed Ali Pasha's son Ibrahim Pasha initiated the first Turkish-Egyptian war, the pretext of which was a quarrel with Abdullah Pasha of Acre. Mohammed Ali Pasha alleged that 6,000 fellaheen peasants had fled to Acre to escape the draft, forced labor, taxes, and he wanted them back. The Egyptians overran most of Syria and its hinterland with ease. The strongest and significant resistance was put up at the port city of Acre. The Egyptian forces eventually captured it after a six-month siege that lasted from 3rd of November 1831 to 27th of May 1832. Unrest on the Egyptian home front increased dramatically as a result of the siege. Mohammed Ali Pasha was forced to squeeze more taxes and forced labor in order to support his campaign, but his people resented the increased burden. After the fall of Acre, the Egyptian army marched north into Anatolia. At the Battle of Konya, 21st December 1832, Ibrahim Pasha soundly defeated the Ottoman army led by the Grand Vizier Rashid Pasha. There were now no military obstacles between Ibrahim Pasha's forces and Constantinople itself. Through the course of the campaign, Mohammed Ali Pasha paid particular attention to the European powers. Fearing another intervention, he proceeded slowly and cautiously. For example, he continued the practice of using the Sultan's name at Friday prayer in the newly captured territories and continued to circulate Ottoman coins instead of issuing new ones bearing his likeness. So long as Mohammed Ali Pasha's march did not threaten to cause the complete collapse of the Ottoman state, the powers in Europe were passive observers. Despite this show, Mohammed Ali Pasha's goal was now to remove the current Ottoman Sultan Mahmud II and replace him with the Sultan's infant son. This possibility so alarmed Mahmud II that he accepted Russia's offer of military aid. Russia's gain dismayed the British and French governments, resulting in their direct intervention. From this position, the European powers brokered a negotiated solution in May 1833. The terms of the peace were that Mohammed Ali Pasha would withdraw his forces from Anatolia, receive the territories of Crete and the Hejaz as compensation, Ibrahim Pasha, his son, would be appointed supreme ruler of Syria. The peace agreement fell short, however, of granting Mohammed Ali Pasha an independent kingdom for himself, leaving him wanting. Sensing that Mohammed Ali Pasha was not content with his gains, the Sultan attempted to preempt further action against the Ottoman Empire by offering him hereditary rule in Egypt and Arabia if he withdrew from Syria, Crete, and renounced any desire for full independence. Mohammed Ali Pasha rejected the offer, knowing that Mahmud II could not force the Egyptian presence from Syria and Crete. New chapter. Title: Freedom. Ahmed Rashid at age 18. The Black Death was on the march again. Cairo was at the heart of it and in quarantine. The Ahmed Aga household was in self-quarantine, as it did in Alexandria a few years earlier, where no one was allowed to come or go. The only lifeline they had was a basket lowered to the ground from the second story by a rope for the exchange of goods and money. No family was spared the scourge. On May 12th, 1834, as Ahmed Aga lay on his deathbed with his extremities turning black, he summoned Ahmed Rashid to his side, raised his right pointing finger at him, and with a raspy voice said, "In the presence of the witnesses in this room, I give you your freedom, Ahmed Rashid." Ahmed Rashid was 18 years old. Ali Gawish Andrun, son of Mustafa Kesarli, was one of the witnesses who handed Ahmed Rashid a gold watch and a silver ink well. Then Muhammad Aga Abe Hassan Istambudi gave him 5 large sacks of coins. All were gifts from Ahmed Aga. Ahmed Rashid was speechless. He bowed to Ahmed Aga and tried to regain his composure as the tears ran down his face. After a minute he raised his head, looked at Ahmed Aga and said, "Only you could have taken the place of my father, Pantalis Pazaris, and given me so much in wealth and courage. Thank you." Word got to Hassan Shaban at the Muhammad Ali Pasha Military Academy in Izna about 2 days later, and he tried to rush home but had a difficult time on account of the quarantine. After pleading with authorities to let him go home, they agreed with the condition that he not return until the quarantine of Cairo is lifted, so he agreed. Hassan Shaban had distinguished himself in military school, achieving highest honors and given the title of Bey. He had also been prepped to take charge of the family if or when Ahmed Aga could no longer do. When he arrived at his home in Al Dawaween, Cairo, he was greeted inside the entrance gates to the compound as master of the household, with the staff lined up in a long row to wish him well. He noticed that Ahmed Rashid was missing from the greeters, and when he inquired why, he was told that Ahmed Rashid was given his freedom. Hassan Shaban Bey was furious. "Only I can give Rashid his freedom," he yelled. "Where is he?" he asked, and a couple of hands pointed up at the balcony, where Ahmed Rashid was standing alongside Khadija Hanim and Hassan Shaban Bey's sister, Salima. He looked up and then said, "I'll deal with him later." That afternoon at lunch, as they all gathered around Hassan Shaban Bey, who by then had gained his composure and was seated in his father's chair at the head of the main dining table, he brought up the subject of Ahmed Rashid's status, and Khadija Hanim spoke up and said, "Your father, may he rest in peace, was so kind as to grant him freedom on his last day in this world. And can you prove that?" Asked Hassan Shaban Bey, and Ahmed Rashid intervened and said that there were witnesses present. "That is no proof you're free. You could have bribed any number of people to say they were witnesses," said Hassan Shaban Bey. "What is needed is a court order to that effect. Can you produce such a document?" Ahmed Rashid could not, and so Hassan Shaban Bey ordered him to attend to the horses in the stable until he could come up with the document. "Aren't you being a little too harsh on him, Hassan Shaban?" said his mother. "You should at least treat him as your father did." "Mother, I am the head of this household now, and what I say is the rule. Is that understood by all?" All who were at the lunch table whispered, "Yes," and nodded their heads to the affirmative. After 2 months, and with the cooperation of Khadija Hanim, a court order was issued on July 14, 1834, granting Ahmed Rashid his freedom, based on the testimony of two witnesses present, who detailed the transaction. Once presented to Hassan Shaban Bey, he was forced to accept the court order. By the time the Black Death curse was over, it had carried away over one-third the population of Cairo, including the life of Salima, the daughter of Khadija Hanim. New chapter. Title: Ubru Kemen. Ahmed Rashid at age 19. "Ahmed, what do you think of marriage?" asked Khadija Hanim as they sat in the upstairs living room in the Al Dawaween house. He lifted his eyes from the book he was reading and replied, "I'm not ready yet for all that." "Well, there is a beautiful young lady of a well-to-do, respectable Turkish family available now, and I would recommend that you seriously consider her," said Khadija Hanim. "I can arrange a meeting of introduction at her house next week, if that is agreeable to you." Her name was Ubru Kemen, the violin's beau, and she lived with her parents in the El Ataba district in Cairo. She was the youngest of three sisters who were already married off. As the appointed day approached, Ahmed Rashid grew more and more nervous. When he was getting ready to go, he managed to put on a mismatched pair of shoes and forgot how to tie his tie, which he ordinarily did quite well. Thanks to Asta Ahmed, he was rushed back up to his room to make the shoe switch and fix the tie. Before heading for the second time down the stairs to the horse-drawn carriage, Asta Ahmed advised him to take his New Order medal and pinned it on the outside of his jacket. As they walked down the stairway, Ahmed Rashid hooked the medal on the inside of his jacket. Her parents were sitting on one side of the reception room, and Khadija Hanim with Ahmed Rashid sat on the other side, all sipping tea. Ubru Kemen's father was a talker, and he went on and on about his agricultural prowess at his many farms in the Nile Delta. As he was sipping at his cup of tea, Khadija Hanim interrupted and said that Ahmed Rashid was an accomplished expert in agriculture too. "He has earned the New Order Medal of Achievement from the Ministry of Public Works for his work and experimentation in converting boorish land to productive croplands." She then nudged Ahmed Rashid to speak up and show his medal. Ahmed Rashid opens up his jacket with hesitation and shows the medal. Ubru Kemen's father was impressed and delighted, engaging him in conversation about his experimentation and its results. After about 10 minutes, the father sits back and all in the room could see the gears tuning in his head. He then whispered into his wife's ear, and she left the room, soon returning with a pretty young lady, and introduced her as their daughter, Ubru Kemen. Ubru Kemen went over to Khadija Hanim and curtsied, then did the same with Ahmed Rashid. She then sat down with her parents and remained silent. This whole production was to introduce the two youngsters to each other. Thereafter, they were allowed to meet each other in either of their houses for tea with chaperones. This visitation arrangement was to see if the two can tolerate each other, to say the least. They were not allowed to touch one another, and had to stay at opposite ends of the tea table. Sometimes they had two, and sometimes three chaperones separating them. One time, the tea table was a little small, and as both Ubru Kemen and Ahmed Rashid reached over to get the teaspoon to the sugar bowl, they actually touched. It was an electrifying moment for Ahmed Rashid, and as he looked at her, he noticed that she immediately looked down smiling. After that incident, he was informed that she likes him and they can proceed with the engagement. A small engagement party was held, which included the reading of the Fatha verse from the Quran by Ahmed Rashid and Ubru Kemen's father to express the intention of marriage. Al-Fatha 1:1. In the name of God, the Lord of Mercy, the Giver of Mercy. 1:2. Praise belongs to God, Lord of the Worlds. 1:3. The Lord of Mercy, the Giver of Mercy. 1:4. Master of the Day of Judgment. 1:5. It is you we worship. It is you we ask for help. 1:6. Guide us to the straight path. 1:7. The path of those you have blessed, those who incur no anger and who have not gone astray. During the engagement period that lasted 5 months, two activities take place. The first is the courtship of the prospective bride and groom, who are allowed to meet outside their homes, but still with chaperones, who would give them more breathing space by sitting at another close-by table, but still responsible for the proper behavior of the two. As for the chaperoned, she was veiled, and they were only to touch hands occasionally, no more, and to engage in platonic conversations. The second activity is the negotiations between the parents as to the date of the wedding, what the dowry will consist of, and contingencies in the event the marriage does not work and they separate. There were difficulties for sure. For one thing, Hassan Shaban Bey had to represent Ahmed Rashid along with Khadija Hanim at the negotiations with Ubru Kemen's parents, and that didn't sit well with Ahmed Rashid. But in the end, he felt that the deal struck was fair. The dowry included a house in El Ataba district in Cairo and two farms outside the city of Tanta in the Nile Delta, known as prime land to plant Egyptian cotton. Ahmed Rashid's obligations were that if in the event of a divorce, he would turn over the house to Ubru Kemen as sell as one of the farms. On one courtship occasion, Ahmed Rashid suggested to Ubru Kemen to hide in the water closet of the eatery they were at. He then told one of the waiters to say that he and Ubru Kemen left the establishment if they were asked, and then he snuck outside when the chaperones were not looking. Well, that created a huge commotion and the feeling of dereliction of duty by the chaperones when the waiter told them the fib. As they panicked, they ran outside. They saw that the horse carriage and Asta Ahmed were still there and asked him if he knew where they were. And just at that moment, Ahmed Rashid appears from behind the carriage and said, "Surprise!" 1 week before the wedding ceremony, Ubru Kemen, Ahmed Rashid and a sheikh, a Muslim holy man, got together at the bride's home for Katbel Kitab, signing of the marriage contract, which was signed by Hassan Shaban Bey, Ubru Kemen's father, and two witnesses. The signed document was then filed. As of that moment, the bride and groom were legally married, but had to wait until the wedding ceremony was over to consummate the marriage. The henna party, bride's shower, came next, where only female friends and relatives are invited. They all dance, sing songs, and present gifts to Ubru Kemen. The wedding ceremony was held the following evening at the groom's home in Al-Dawaween. The bride and groom sat in two chairs separated by a space of about 1 foot and to one side of the downstairs living room. As the guests arrived, they were given a memento of the wedding and were seated. The walima was performed next, the serving of food. As the evening progressed, there was music and dancing by the ladies. In the background could be heard the zagrata, a unique Arab vocalization of the hired help. When the party was over, Ahmed Rashid and Ubru Kemen retired to their rooms on the upper north wing of the Al-Dawaween house. This arrangement was necessary because Ahmed Rashid could not support financially a household on account farms were heavily taxed for Muhammad Ali Pasha's war machines. New chapter. Title: In Search of Family. Ahmed Rashid, at age 21. He opened the large trunk that sat in the corner of the sitting room to find the 5 large bags of coins given to him by Ahmed Aga. He found them all right, but missing was any sign of mementos from his Greek origins. As tears rolled down his cheeks, he thought of the last time he saw his mother and sister, Ekaterini. By this time, Ubru Keman had given him 2 children. First, there was Ahmed Rashid II, who was now 1.5 years old. Second, there came Farida Rashid, who was 5 months old. Ubru Keman was a loving mother and supporter of her husband. He worked as an agricultural expert at the Ministry of Public Works at a modest salary, just enough to support some of the expenses of the Al-Dawaween household, and definitely not enough for any extra activities such as taking a trip back to his island of Chios in search of his family, a thought which now lay heavily in his mind. He picked one of the bags of coins and set it aside on the floor. Ubru Keman walked over to him, with Farida saddled on her right hip, and asked what the bag had in it. He explained that it was a gift from Ahmed Aga, and that he intended to use it to travel back to Chios to find his Greek family. She didn't really understand how important this was to him, but kept silent anyway in hopes he might change his mind. But his mind was made up. He was going to Chios. His first stop was Alexandria. He attempted to enter the port, but was stopped by a soldier at the gate. "What is your business here?" asked the soldier, and Ahmed Rashid said that he was looking for passage to the island of Chios. He was led into the docks area, and he went from one ship to the next, inquiring. It was a rough sea day, and he had to rush from ship to ship to escape the gushing water between them. He spent most of the morning in this endeavor before he reached the end of the line and had to turn back with empty hopes. He repeated this process for 2 more days with no passage. On the 4th day, he decided to ask the soldier at the gate if there are any ships headed to the island of Chios that dock there. The soldier answered, "No, there is no one on the island of Chios. They were killed, taken away, or escaped." Ahmed Rashid had heard a story about what had happened to the island of Chios, but hoped it was just a rumor, and it was a shock to hear the same story again from this soldier. "What proof do you have of all this?" asked Ahmed Rashid, and the soldier responded by saying that he was there as part of the contingent that attacked. Defeated, he returned to town, sat at a cafe to rest his legs, ordered a cup of Turkish coffee, and collected his thoughts. When the waiter approached to take his order, Ahmed Rashid noticed that he had green eyes, an uncommon sight. He made a guess as to the origin of those eyes, communicated his order in Greek, and to his surprise they answered back in Greek, putting smiles crossed both their faces. They greeted one another and introduced themselves. His name was Nikolaos Talos, and he was from the island of Crete. When asked if he knew anything about the island of Chios, Nikolaos responded by saying most of its inhabitants indeed had been killed, and the rest were taken prisoner or escaped. "But why?" asked Ahmed Rashid, and Nikolaos said it was because of the War of Independence. "You see, a contingent of Greek freedom fighters from the island of Samos landed on the island, convinced the Greek leaders to join the revolution, and they agreed. This revolt by the Chians caused the anger of the Sultan, and he ordered the severe punishment for the islanders by sending a fleet of ships to put it down ruthlessly." Ahmed Rashid's head dropped onto his lap in despair, assuming that he has lost his family forever. Nikolaos taped him on the shoulder and said, "If I were you, I don't know what I would do. One never knows what one might find in one's future." "But where should I start looking?" asked Ahmed Rashid, and Nikolaos suggested the island of Chios, because a handful of people survived and still remain there. "But I have tried for 4 days, and there seems to be no passage to the island. Try the close-by islands of Samos or Sara, and get passage to Chios, from there would be my guess. It is also very close to the city of Smyrna on the Anatolia side." With those suggested places to start, Ahmed Rashid decided to restart his hunt for passage, and he departed thanking Nikolaos for his help. The next day, Ahmed Rashid returned to the docks of Alexandria, once again determined to find his way to Chios. He walked from ship to ship along the dock as he had done before, and indeed found passage on one ship headed for Smyrna in Anatolia the next day. The journey to Smyrna took 3 weeks. They arrived at the break of dawn that day, and Ahmed Rashid immediately started looking for passage to Chios, which he didn't find right off. He did find a ferry that crossed the Aegean Sea to the port city of Chios, but it was 25 miles away due west, so he hired ground transport. It took the better part of the day to reach the ferry, but it had just returned from Chios and was not headed out again until the next day. The sea was rough that morning, and he got soaking wet by the time he reached the port city of Chios. Very few buildings were still standing. Generally, the streets were cluttered with debris, and very few people were walking around. He got off the ferry on the north side of town, started to walk towards its center, when he met an old man walking with a cane, and asked him if he could point him to the village of Vervarato. The old man told him to walk to the next intersection, turn left, and then walk for about 4 miles up the mountain, and he will arrive there. He met a few people on the way, and inquired if he was walking in the right direction. As he got to where he thought Vervarato was, judging by the distance he had walked, he looked around, but could not recognize any of the buildings or streets. His duffel bag was starting to get heavy, so he looked for a tree, sat under it, leaning back on its sloping trunk, and soon fell asleep. Soon a young girl yanked on his sleeve and asked him to play with her. It was Ekaterini, his sister. She pulled him up from the tree and into one of the houses nearby, which he recognized as his old home, so he started to play master of the house as she played the dutiful wife. As she was handing him a cup of tea, their mother rushes in, grabs Ekaterini around the waist and him by the hand, yelling, "Hurry, come with me." They run outside and are confronted by a soldier on horseback who rushed at them, yanked Ekaterini from her mother's arm, and galloped off with her screaming, "Mama, mama!" Demetrius immediately tried to follow them, but he tripped on a fallen branch and knocked his head on a tree trunk. As he stumbled to regain his balance, the horsemen and Ekaterini were nowhere to be seen, so he looked back to where his mother should have been, but could only see his duffel bag. He soon realized he was dreaming. After rubbing his eyes, he picked up the duffel bag and started to walk further up the road. He soon came across a goat herder and asked him if the village of Vervarato was close by. The goat herder said that they were standing in what is left of it. "Have you lived here long?" asked Ahmed Rashid, and the goat herder answered, "No. I am originally from the island of Sara, and I have only been roaming these hills with my goats for the past year or so. I heard that many Chians escaped to Sara during the massacre here. Is that true?" "Yes," said the goat herder, "but almost all Sarians along with the Chians who had escaped there perished." "How was that?" asked Ahmed Rashid. "On July 4, 1824, the resistance of the Sarians to the Ottoman Empire ended with a last stand at the town's old fort of Palaiocastro. An Ottoman force of about 2,000 soldiers stormed the fort where hundreds of soldiers and also women and children had taken refuge. The refugees first threw a white flag at the Ottoman troops with the words, 'Freedom or death.' At the moment the Ottomans entered the fort, a local man named Antonios Vratsanos lit a fuse to the stock of gunpowder, resulting in an explosion that killed the town's people, along with their enemies. A Frenchman who heard and saw the explosion compared it to a volcanic eruption," replied the goat herder. "All the thatched roofs had collapsed into their buildings in Vervarato, or were blown away, leaving empty shells that stood open to the heavens above, crying for justice. Night was upon him now, and he chose to lay rest in one of those open testaments to the cruelty of humankind. He put on an extra layer of clothing, as Chios is known for cold winter nights. He then lay down with his head on the duffel bag, looking up at the stars above until he fell asleep. Not having eaten for the past 2 days, Ahmed Rashid climbed a tree to try to spot any signs of life around him. He notices smoke perhaps from a campfire about a mile away and proceeded to hike in its direction. When he arrived, it was indeed a campfire, built by a family of goat herders, one of whom was the goat herder he met the day before. They welcomed him, asked him to sit with them,
have a bite to eat and some tea. He introduced himself as Dimitris Penzaris, a once resident of Vervorado, and that he was looking for his mother and sister. None of them recognized the name as being of anybody around that area. After eating, he thanked them for their kindness and went on his way looking further up the mountain. But the story was the same, no matter where he traveled for 8 days, and so he gave up on finding them on the island. Many of whom he met suggested to him to try the island of Samos, and so he decided to head in that direction. Unfortunately, he did not find them there either. Some on the island of Samos suggested looking on the island of Syros, 60 miles to the west. So he got passage to Syros, arriving 2 months into his journey from Alexandria. The city of Hermopolis on the island of Syros was founded in 1821, at the beginning of the Greek War of Independence. Most immigrants were from Chios and Sara, trying to re-establish their lucrative trade businesses they had at home, but failed because of its internationally unfavorable location. Nevertheless, it remained an important port of call for the Cyclades. Ahmed Rashid would stroll from his rented room to the seashore cafe of John Colac to have a cup of tea and read the local newspaper that he bought from an attractive girl on the corner of the street before heading out to hunt for any clues as the whereabouts of his mother and Ekaterini, if they are indeed on the island. After 2 weeks of searching, he was losing hope. It seemed no one recognized the name Panzaris anywhere. One morning, he decided to approach the paper girl and asked her for her name. She said that people called her Trini, and when he asked her for her last name, she responded by saying, Vikis. Do you know of anybody who can help me find my mother and sister? He asked. Like a historian or something? She responded. Someone who would know all who came to this island or had a record of such, he said. I don't know of anybody who did that, she responded. But my husband, Miltiades, might know of someone who did, she continued. Is there a chance I could meet your husband? Asked Ahmed Rashid. I'll ask him tonight when I go home and let you know tomorrow. The next day he approached her on the street corner and bought the paper as usual and asked her if she had any success in having her husband meet with him. Yes, a matter of fact, you are invited to lunch this afternoon at our apartment. And there you can ask him as many questions as you would like. At about 3 p.m., he showed up at her street corner and followed her to the apartment. It was a modest affair. Her husband was dressed up and with a stiff back greeted Ahmed Rashid and asked him into the dining area to sit at the head of the table. The table was all set, and as he sat down, Trini came into the room, poured water into the water glasses, and sat next to her husband. Soon an elderly woman enters with a large pot of chicken soup and laid it on the table in front of Miltiades. As Miltiades was serving, Ahmed Rashid couldn't help himself stare at the elderly woman. Something about her seemed very familiar, and suddenly a shock wave ran through his veins as he realized it was his mother. He then turned to Trini, realized she was Ekaterini, jumps up and yells her name in absolute joy. Trini was startled and answered, "Yes?" It's me, Dimitris Panzaris, your brother and I am your son Mama, as he turns toward his mother and hugs her. Trini rushes in on the cuddling and they all cry in exultation. Just then a baby started to cry from an adjoining room. Trini excused herself, left the room, returned with a baby in her arms and gave her to Dimitri. Aglaia is her name and she is your niece, Dimitris. Oh, joy to the world, he exclaimed. New chapter. Title: The Proposal. After spending 2 weeks with Ekaterini, her family and his mother, Ubru Kemen and their children were increasingly on his mind, and so Ahmed Rashid decided to return to Egypt. It was a somewhat easy decision, especially now that he knew his Greek family was safe, doing well, and he could contact them if the need arose. Returning home to Al-Dawawin, Cairo, he was greeted by his Egyptian family with delight. He swore that Ahmed II had grown an inch and could not believe that Farida was walking with some support from Dada Naboya, her nanny. Khadija Hanim still wore a black galabia and black scarf. Hassan Shaban Bey married Soher Abdel Futu and moved out of the Al-Dawawin house to a house of his own in a district called Al-Manshia. Ahmed Rashid returned to his job as an agricultural expert at the Ministry of Public Works. Feeling that he needed to do something more,
and stop depending on other people, such as living in the Yale Dawawin house, even though he was contributing about a quarter of the expenses. Despite the fact that he owned three farms totaling 400 acres, he decided to find a way to make more money and move into his house in Elataba. He figured that if he was able to provide for a quarter of a household's expenses with the land that he had, then it would take about 1,600 acres to provide for a full household. His expertise was in boorish lands, and so he decided to make a survey of all such lands in the Nile Delta. He spent the next 3 months traveling from Delta District to the next mapping out these boorish lands, after which he organized a list of them in order of size from largest first to smallest last. He had four large bags of coins left of Ahmed Aga's gift to him, and he decided to spend it all in buying as much boorish land, starting with the largest boorish land parcels. Boorish lands were worthless to the people who owned them, and so they were glad to get rid of them and gave them up in return of almost nothing. Ahmed Rashid ended up with about 4,500 acres of boorish land in his name. Next, he requested a meeting with the Minister of Public Works and was granted one on the morning of October 12, 1837. On the appointed date, Ubru Kemen made sure he was dressed properly with a tie, and she hung the new order star on his lapel. Osta Ahmed had the carriage ready for him on time, and off they went. "Good morning, Labib Bey," said Ahmed Rashid as he entered the minister's office with a roll of maps under his arm. The minister extended his hand and Ahmed Rashid took it and gave it one firm shake. After the small talk, Ahmed Rashid opened the serious conversation by saying, "I have a plan to increase agricultural output in the Nile Delta rejoined by about 1%. "How do you propose to accomplish that, Ahmed?" "You know me, Labib Bey, I am your boorish land expert, and I have been working diligently at estimating the area of boorish land that can be converted economically to productive lands that exists in the Delta, and it's about 1%. That's a lot of land you're talking about, maybe about 200,000 acres. How long will it take to convert all this boorish soil to productive agricultural land?" Ahmed Rashid responded by saying, "We will not do it all at once. We can split the land into three consecutive sectors at 1 year each. The projects can be completed in about 3 years." "And what resources will you need to accomplish this?" asked the minister, and Ahmed Rashid answered, "A considerable amount of labor to dig irrigation and drainage waterways." "And where do you propose to get this labor force?" asked the minister. "I was considering approaching the finance ministry for financial support, with your approval, to hire local laborers in exchange for the large payback in taxes when the land becomes productive." "And have you approached the owners of these boorish soils with this proposal?" asked the minister, and Ahmed Rashid responded, "Well, I own a very small fraction, but the rest of the owners don't know yet. I was waiting until the Ministry of Public Works approve and finalize the plan." "Very well," said the minister. "But leave the financial aspects to me, for I will contact the finance ministry, negotiate the terms, and make the appropriate arrangements. Meanwhile, you'll inform the landowners of the project and its particulars within the next month and a half. I will expect you to manage the whole project starting about 6 months from today." That night, Ahmed Rashid had a very hard time sleeping from all the thoughts riding through his head regarding the boorish land project. He had never managed such a large project before, and to be handed such a large responsibility was almost overwhelming. He realized the magnitude of the planning, setting in place the checks and balances for effective management, and wondered whether he could do it. Ubru Kemen only had words of encouragement and confidence in Ahmed Rashid's abilities to manage his project to success. 2 weeks later, the Minister of Public Works, Labib Bey, called on Ahmed Rashid to meet with him and discuss the boorish land project. What they covered in the meeting was how the project will be paid for. On his end, Ahmed Rashid was to submit a month's labor requirements in advance to the Ministry of Public Works. A week after which, the Ministry of Public Works will expect him to sign for the receipt of funds he requested for this labor. This process will last for 3 years unless an extension is required, at which time the Ministry of Public Works will have to negotiate a new contract. On April 23, 1839, an old man with a cane, a file under his arm, approached Ahmed Rashid at his project headquarters in the city of Tanta and introduced himself as Mustafa Effendi from the Finance Ministry's auditing department. He explained to Ahmed Rashid that all projects paid for by the Ministry of Finance are audited once a year. Ahmed Rashid shook his hand, let him sit down at his desk, and asked how he could help him do his audit. At that time, the first sector of the project was completed, and the second sector was being started. Mustafa Effendi requested the project's labor logs and receipts. They were provided by Ahmed Rashid, who told Mustafa Effendi he could use any desk he wanted in the office for his work. Ahmed Rashid instructed his staff to give Mustafa Effendi any project paperwork he wanted. Mustafa Effendi had mentioned that the audit should take about a week. 9 days later, Mustafa Effendi approached Ahmed Rashid and asked him if he knew why there is such a large discrepancy between the Ministry of Public Works books and those of the project. "What do you mean, Mustafa Effendi?" "Sniff. Take, for example, month 4 of the project. Public Works has a receipt from you receiving 115,587 piastres, while you claim that you only received 15,587 piastres. How do you explain that?" "That is a large discrepancy, I have to admit. Do you have the book with the copies of the receipts that I signed?" asked Ahmed Rashid, and the auditor reaches over and handed him the book of receipts. Ahmed Rashid flipped, thought the book to month 4, and indeed it said that he received 15,587 piastres. He then pointed to that figure, then to his signature on the receipt copy, and said to the auditor that that was all he had received that month. The auditor shook his head and said, "Sniff, every month shows a large discrepancy between your books and those of the Ministry of Public Works and the Ministry of Finance. It is not my place to point fingers, but I have to report my findings to my superiors. What I can tell you is that you owe the Ministry of Finance the amount of 1,207,509 piastres according of the books." Ahmed Rashid grabbed his forehead and stumbled a few of steps backwards, crashing into the wall behind him as he tried to comprehend what he got himself into. Within 2 weeks, Ahmed Rashid was escorted to the Al Saida Zainab jailhouse, where he occupied cell number 158, accused of theft. Ubru Kamen took him food every day and tried to cheer him up. Hassan Shaban Bey took it upon himself to hire the best lawyer available, who was the well-respected former judge Abdelhamid Bey. But Ahmed Rashid thanked both of them for their help and said he is going to defend himself despite their objections. Al Alam newspaper estimated that its audience would be interested in this story, so it published the headline, "Local Yokel Hoodwinks the Ministry of Finance for over a million piastres," writing how inept the ministry was in managing the crown's funds. This news caught the public's eye and the circulation of the newspaper soared. It also caught the eye of the supreme leader himself, Muhammad Ali Pasha, who wanted to hang the offender, but was persuaded by his grandson, Abbas Hilmi, not to, on account Ahmed Rashid was a boyhood friend of his. Ahmed Rashid stood in an iron cage to the left of the presiding judge. The prosecutor stood in front of the judge, and behind him sat a crowd of onlookers. The prosecutor started by stating the charges the Crown has brought against the accused, Ahmed Rashid, namely the theft of 1,274,509 piastres and the penalty of death by hanging. The onlookers burst into a chorus of, "Hang the son of a bitch." The judge yelled, "Quiet," as he hammered his desk with the gavel. The prosecutor then proceeded to explain how Ahmed Rashid, who was the project manager for the Borish Land Reclamation Project, doctored up his books to show that he received a fraction of the monies actually given to him by forging copies of the original receipts. Only the son of a Greek peasant and former slave could come up with such a stupid idea in the first place. He didn't realize the meticulous details the Ministries of Finance and Public Works keep and the process of frequent auditing, said the prosecutor. The prosecutor went on to say that Ahmed Rashid was a danger to society. He more likely will repeat the offense and should be put to death. The onlookers burst again into a chorus of, "Hang him high," and the judge again yelled, "Quiet," as he pounded his desk with the gavel. The judge then asked who was representing the accused. Hassan Shaban Bey and Abdelhamid Bey were seated in the front row with the onlookers. Abdelhamid Bey raised his voice and said, "I will, Your Honor. I am Abdelhamid Bey, and I will be representing Ahmed Rashid." Just then, Ahmed Rashid spoke up and said, "I wish to represent myself, Your Honor." But the judge ordered him to be quiet. "Don't you know how much trouble you're in?" The judge then told Abdelhamid Bey to come forward and defend the accused against the charges presented by the prosecution. "I need a couple of days to prepare my defense, Your Honor. All I can say at this time is, Ahmed Rashid is one of the most honest men I know, and that he does not have it in him to do what the state accuses him of doing. But, Your Honor, I can defend myself," said Ahmed Rashid from the iron cage, and the judge again told him to be quiet. "I deny the defense's request for more time. However, I will grant you 2 hours to prepare. Court is in recess until an hour after noon prayer." As the courtroom was being cleared, Abdelhamid Bey rushed to the iron cage and asked Ahmed Rashid how he was going to defend himself. Ahmed Rashid pulled a sheet of paper from his pant pocket, gave it to him, and told him that it was his defense. Abdelhamid Bey looked at the crumpled piece of paper and saw that it contained a bunch of numbers. "What do all these numbers mean?" he asked. "They are the key to my defense. See the first column of number. They represent what I received, and the second column of numbers is what they claim I received." "So what do they indicate?" asked Abdelhamid Bey. "The second column has exaggerated numbers added to them," said Ahmed Rashid. "These exaggerated numbers are the difference between my numbers and their numbers. For example, if you look at month 4, my number is 15,587, and their number is 115,587, where there is a 1 added to my number, and so on. Another example is month 12, where there is a 7 added to the end of my number in the second column," added Ahmed Rashid. "I don't really understand. Are you saying that someone was adding numbers to the receipts after you signed them?" asked Abdelhamid Bey. "Exactly. Not only that, they were adding numbers to my requests for labor funding too. The end result is, if you subtract my total from their total, you will come up with what they claim I stole, which is exactly 1,274,509 piastres." "This is a wild and dangerous, Ahmed Rashid. In essence, you are saying that the Crown is guilty of forgery. They can have our heads for this, you know," said Abdelhamid Bey. "That is why I insist on mounting my own defense, since I am a dead man anyway." After noon prayer, the courtroom started to fill with onlookers. The judge, prosecutor, and Abdelhamid Bey went back and sat with Hassan Shaban Bey among the spectators. At the appointed hour, the judge pounded the gavel on his desk, and the trial started again. "Abdelhamid Bey, why are you sitting with the audience and not at the defense table?" Abdelhamid Bey got up and said, "The accused insisted on defending himself, Your Honor." "What nonsense is this? The accused can't defend himself in this courtroom," said the judge. "It's my only chance to clear my name, Your Honor," said Ahmed Rashid. "For the last time, be quiet," answered the judge. "No one would dare defend me because of what I can prove, Your Honor," said Ahmed Rashid. The judge paused for a minute and then said, "It is highly unusual for the accused to defend themselves in a court of law." He then paused another minute and said, "I will allow the accused to present to me his case in the next half hour, only after which I will decide if he should defend himself." "Thank you, Your Honor," said Ahmed Rashid, as he stuck his arm out from behind the bars of the cage and motioned for the court clerk to take the piece of paper which contained the lists of numbers to give to the judge. The judge looked at the paper and asked what it was about, and Ahmed Rashid explained its significance, as he had done with Abdelhamid Bey. "So this piece of paper presents how the differences between your books and those of the ministry could have been created, but it does not point to who changed what figures." "Yes, Your Honor. It is a matter of either I removed the exaggerated numbers or someone else added them, and since the receipts for the monies were written in ink, I could not have been able to rub them out." "Very well. But you could have created from scratch your own receipts now, couldn't you?" countered the judge. "That is true, Your Honor, but the receipts have the Crown's seal on them, which I could not have been able to do," replied Ahmed Rashid. The judge ruled, "The accused can represent himself." The trial continued over the next 2 weeks. The whole case centered on if Ahmed Rashid's receipts were authentic or not. the prosecution could not show how the accused created such authentic-looking receipts with the Crown seal. Ahmed Rashid quickly turned the attention of the court to the possibility that the receipts in the ministry's possession were altered to show amounts greater than what appeared on Ahmed Rashid's receipts. Unfortunately, he wasn't able to show any receipt held by the Ministry of Public Works had been altered, since all ink used appeared the same, and there were no smudges. He was, however, able to demonstrate to the court that it was too much of a coincidence that single numbers added to the beginning or to the end of his receipt figures came out to exactly the amount they claim he stole from the ministry. "The coincidence of this happening is zero," said Ahmed Rashid. He went on to say, "And since my receipts have been proven to be authentic, and it remains to be unclear whether the ministry's receipts were altered or not, the burden of proof that the ministry's receipts were not altered rests with the Ministry of Public Works." The courtroom onlookers suddenly gasped loudly, for Prefall here was a commoner and former slave accusing the Crown's Ministry of Public Works of forgery and embezzlement. "Quiet in the court," said the judge as he pounded his desk with his gavel. The judge at this point ordered the accused released from the iron cage and set free. He then proclaimed that the trial was not over. "Clearly, there is the issue of the missing 1,274,509 piastres that we need to uncover at the Ministry of Public Works, for only there could the documents have been altered." The judge then looked at the prosecutor and said, "Who is the responsible person for the Ministry of Public Works?" The prosecutor paused for a minute, then said, "His Grandest, Labib Bey, Your Honor, is the ultimate person of responsibility for the Ministry of Public Works." "Very well. Please have His Grandest, Labib Bey, present tomorrow in this courtroom to answer questions regarding the Borish Land Reclamation Project finances," requested the judge. The next day, Labib Bey was called up by the judge, who asked him, "Your Grandest, Labib Bey, we had discovered that your organization had altered its book to show that the Borish Land Reclamation Project requested far more financial resources than the project manager reports he had received. Are you aware of this?" "I am now, Your Honor," answered Labib Bey. "How do you explain this large discrepancy?" asked the judge. "I can't, Your Honor. Our books have been audited, and they all balance against the Ministry of Finance accounting books. I assume this means that we have done nothing wrong, Your Honor." "You don't seem to understand, Your Grandest, Labib Bey, that it has been proven that your organization is at fault with respect to altering the receipts signed by the accused. What do you say to that?" "I don't know how that is possible, nor do my financial accountants seem to know how that could have been accomplished, Your Honor." "Stop stonewalling me on this issue. Do you agree that your organization is at fault in this matter?" asked the judge. "I beg your pardon, Your Honor, but I can't agree unless someone gives me a clue as to who done it and how they did it. I can see that you are not going to budge from your stance, Your Grandest, Labib Bey. I therefore call the cancellation of the Borish Land Reclamation Project until this matter is resolved. I further declare that the accused is innocent of the charge of theft and free to go," said the judge. Then he pounded his gavel and declared the trial over. Al Alam newspaper declared that Ahmed Rashid was the genius who was able to prove that his organization was not at fault, using mathematics and logic to make his case. And ever since, he was called upon to solve other cases for the courts. The news of the trial's outcome reached the ears of Muhammad Ali Pasha, and he ordered that Labib Bey be removed from the Ministry of Public Works and jailed. He consulted with his top advisors, and they suggested the genius with numbers, Ahmed Rashid, replaced Labib Bey as Minister of Public Works with a hefty increase in salary. As a result, Ahmed Rashid was promoted to the rank of Mir Lua, Army General, which carried the title of Pasha. On the home front, his 4,500 acres of Borish land was successfully converted into productive agricultural land, which was then contributing to the war economy. He was also able to move out of the Al Dawaween house and into his own house in El Ataba district of Cairo with his wife, kids, and servants. New chapter. Title: The Battle for Independence. Ahmed Rashid, at age 22, on May 25, 1838, Muhammad Ali Pasha informed Britain and France that he intended to declare independence from the Ottoman Empire, contrary to the desire of the European powers to maintain the status quo within the Ottoman Empire. With Muhammad Ali Pasha's intentions clear, the European powers, particularly Russia, attempted to moderate the situation and prevent conflict. Within the empire, however, both sides were gearing for war. Ibrahim Pasha already had a sizable force in Syria. In Constantinople, the Ottoman commander Hafiz Pasha assured the Sultan Mahmud II that he could defeat the Egyptian army. When the Sultan Mahmud II ordered his forces to advance on the Syrian frontier, Ibrahim Pasha attacked and destroyed them at the Battle of Nezib on June 24, 1839 near Urfa. Constantinople was again left vulnerable to Muhammad Ali Pasha's forces. A further blow to the Ottomans was the defection of their fleet to Muhammad Ali Pasha. The Sultan Mahmud II died almost immediately after the battle took place and was succeeded by 16-year-old Abdulmecid. At this point, Muhammad Ali Pasha and his son Ibrahim Pasha began to argue about which course to follow. Ibrahim Pasha favored conquering the Ottoman capital and demanding the imperial seat, while Muhammad Ali Pasha was inclined simply to demand numerous concessions of territory and political autonomy for himself and his family. The European powers again intervened. And on the July 15, 1840, the British government, which had colluded with Austria, Prussia, and Russia to sign the Convention of London, offered Muhammad Ali Pasha hereditary rule of Egypt as part of the Ottoman Empire if he withdrew from the Syrian hinterland and the coastal regions of Mount Lebanon. Muhammad Ali Pasha hesitated, believing he had support from France, but in the end that failed to materialize. British naval forces moved against Syria and Alexandria. After the British and Austrian navies blockaded the Nile Delta coastline, shelled the city of Beirut, Lebanon on September 11, 1840, and after the city of Acre, Palestine had capitulated on November 3, 1840, Muhammad Ali Pasha agreed to the terms of the convention on November 27, 1840. Those terms included renouncing his claims to Crete, Hejaz, downsizing his navy, and reducing his standing army to 18,000 men in exchange that he and his descendants enjoy hereditary rule over Egypt and the Sudan. March 29, 1841. My dearest Demetrius, the city of Hermopolis on the island of Syros greets you for the sun shining today. I have great news. You are an uncle for the second time. I have given birth to little Tadaki with all 10 fingers and toes. Right now he is in Aglaia's arms while I write to you. Mama, Miltiadis, Aglaia, and I send you our love and hope you are in good health and spirits. We wish you could come and visit with us soon. Ekaterini, July 30, 1841. Dearest Ekaterini, the birth of Tadaki is great news indeed. I can't wait until I get a chance to see you all again. On my end, things are not so good. Egypt has been at war with the great powers, and the casualties are streaming into Egypt from the Syria, Lebanon, and Palestine. One who did not return was my dear brother, Hassan Shaban Bey, son of Ahmed Aga, who left behind a 6-year-old boy, Abdul Hamid Sadiq. Khadija Hanim, his mother, took care of little Abdul Hamid as long as she could, and then I took him in. Another casualty was El Said Dukduki Bey, who was an assistant to me at the Ministry of Finance, who volunteered and joined the war efforts in Syria. He was a young chap who had just married Miss Lear the Slovak. He too never returned from the battlefield, and as it is permitted in Islam to have more than one wife, I married the widow Miss Lear, who has given me 2 sons, Ibrahim Rashid and Mustafa Rashid. So now you are an aunt twice over. I wish all of you could just move over here to Egypt, for I am now able to provide for you. I hope you think seriously about it. Respectfully and forever yours, Demetrius, September 30, 1841. Dear Demetrius, what a surprise that you have married Miss Lear. Please excuse my nosiness, but we do not understand the situation. What happened to Ubru Keman? We do understand that in Egypt the Muslims can marry more than one wife at the same time, and we were hoping that that was not the case with you. Love always, Ekaterini. November 25, 1841. Dear Ekaterini, yes, I have 2 wives now. I am a man with means and can provide for 2 households. One household in the El Ataba district of Cairo for Ebru Keman and our children, as well as another household for Miss Lear and our children in the district of Al Azhar. Each household has its own allocation of land of approximately 500 acres each for income. The staff is managed by Ubru Keman and Miss Liar respectively, and all finances are controlled by me. As for any moral duties, I am a Muslim now, and it is my obligation as a man of means to marry and support a woman widowed by war. Give my love to all, Dimitris. New chapter. Title: Capitulation. Ahmed Rashid, at age 27. The Egyptian government had also to tear down its import barriers to European goods, abolish labor camps, and reduce the burden of taxes. Mohammed Ali Pasha's mind became increasingly clouded and tended towards paranoia caused by senility. In 1844, the tax receipts were in, and Sharif Bey, the finance minister, was too fearful for his life to tell Mohammed Ali Pasha the news that Egypt was in a financial crisis, owing the equivalent of 80 million francs. Timidly, Sharif Bey approached Ibrahim Pasha with the facts, and together they came up with a report and a plan. Anticipating his father's initial reaction, Ibrahim Pasha arranged for Mohammed Ali Pasha's favorite daughter, Montaz, break the news. It did little, if any, good. The resulting rage was far beyond what any had been expected, and it took 6 full days for a tenuous peace to take hold. His salinity became so apparent to the point where his adopted son and heir, the mortally ailing Ibrahim Pasha, who suffered from rheumatic pains and tuberculosis, had no choice but to travel to Constantinople and request that the Sultan recognize him ruler of Egypt, even though his father was still alive. The request was granted, and so he became Ibrahim Pasha ruler of Egypt. On the ship returning home, Ibrahim Pasha, gripped by fever, succumbed to seizures and hallucinations. He survived the journey, but within 3 months was dead. He was succeeded by Al-Khedive Abbas Pasha in ruling Egypt in 1848. By 1849, Mohammed Ali Pasha had become so ill that he was not informed of his son's death or of the ascent of Al-Khedive Abbas Pasha to supreme ruler of Egypt and Sudan. Lingering a few months more, he died at Ras el-Tin Palace in Alexandria on August 2, 1849, and ultimately was buried in the imposing mosque he had commissioned in the Cairo Citadel. The immediate reaction to his death was noticeably low-key, thanks in no small part to the contempt of Al-Khedive Abbas Pasha had towards his grandfather. New chapter. New chapter. Title: Delbar, Key. Ahmed Rashid at age 32. Al-Khedive Abbas Pasha undid many of the works of his grandfather. Among other things, he abolished trade monopolies, closed factories, schools, and reduced the strength of the army to 9,000 men. He also shut down construction of the Nile Delta Dam, which was supposed to improve irrigation of agricultural lands, and opposed the construction of the Suez Canal, which was a shipping waterway from the Mediterranean Sea to the Red Sea. He kicked out all foreign business and others interested in Egypt's and the Sudan's riches. At the insistence of the British government, he allowed the construction of a railway from Alexandria to Cairo, in return for the British assisting him in disputes with the Ottoman Empire. Al-Khedive Abbas Pasha assigned Ahmed Pasha Rashid on as finance minister because he had demonstrated fiscal restraint in the face of Mohammed Ali Pasha's expansionist agenda. Ahmed Pasha Rashid built a farmhouse on his farm in Ganag in the Nile Delta, and he would visit it once a month to collect rent and produce for his 2 families in Cairo. The farmhouse was shaped like a horseshoe with an inner courtyard. On one side was his family living quarters, and on the other side was the help's quarters, which also had the kitchen. He would look forward to his visits to Ganag because of one person. This was the cook who was always singing while she worked, either washing dishes or preparing him his requested meal. Her name was Delbar, and she was from Iran. She claimed she was a young princess when abducted and sold to a slave trader named Mullah Mokhtar, who sold her to Ahmed Aga. She was set free at the same time Ahmed Pasha Rashid was set free when Ahmed Aga was on his deathbed. Being a single woman, she was at a disadvantage, so Ahmed Pasha Rashid took her in and gave her the job of cook at Ganag. Every morning, Delbar would call out to him below his upstairs window when he woke up and say, "Oh, white evening," and he would open the shutters and answer, "Yes, white evening," meaning that he had a good night. One morning he answered, "Oh, black evening," and she replied, "Why?" and he said that he could not get to sleep on account of the mosquitoes. She was singing and dancing as she climbed up the stairs to his bedroom and knocked on the door. He let her in, and she immediately inspected the mosquito netting for holes, and sure enough, she found a couple. Men of his stature were not supposed to notice what he sensed in her. He felt her free-spirited sensuality, but pretended to himself that it didn't matter. When she said she would fix the holes later, he asked her to fix them. "Now!" "But Ahmed Pasha, I need to fix your breakfast," he insisted. He could not help but want to watch her close by fix the mosquito net. The whole day was a waste as far as collecting rent from the peasants, for his defenses were down on account of the sleepless night, and all he could think about the cheerful Delbar. When she served him dinner, he asked her to take a break and follow him to the living room. He sat down on the couch, and she sat on the floor next to him, and he asked her to tell him her story about her days as a princess. She described her home as having pillars up to the ceilings and the maids that attended to her morning, afternoon, and evening dresses. Other brushed her hair and bathed her every day. Her favorite activity was riding the sail ship on the blue waters of Iranian Ocean. Her descriptions were so vivid she convinced him that she was really a lost princess, as she had said. What he had in his heart would be unacceptable to his wives, Ubru Kaman and Misliar, and so he tried to figure out how to work it out. He then built up the courage and asked Delbar to wed him. She accepted a couple of days later, but she was also concerned about how this marriage would be accepted. He proposed they keep it a secret, and that he would give her the farmhouse to live in, and she could stay there away from the critical eyes of society. She agreed to this setup, but word got to Cairo anyway by the help that traveled back and forth with Ahmed Pasha Rashid, and he had to explain himself, which he did, basing his argument on the fact that she is an Iranian princess. This created an uneasy peace with Ubru Kaman and Misliar, until Delbar gave birth to a baby girl they named Khadija, after Khadija Hanim, wife of Ahmed Aga, which made her an official member of the family. On the 13th of July 1854, Al-Khadija Abbas Pasha was murdered at the Benha Palace by two of his slaves. This set off a firestorm of speculation of what minister will survive and what minister will be replaced. January 12th, 1855, Dearest Demetris, we have great news to tell you. We have a new member of the family named Agatha. She is a little temperamental, unlike Tadaki and Aglaya, who were quiet babies and well-behaved. Little Agatha has a mind of her own and demands satisfaction. She is a handful. On a more serious note, Mama is not doing so well. She walks with a cane now and can barely get around the apartment. Right now she has a cough that is deep in her chest. The doctor has given her syrup to take twice a day. Hope you can come and visit with us. We miss you so much. Love always, Ekaterini, July 1st, 1855. Dear Ekaterini, I am terribly upset about Mama and her condition. What else is being done for her? I wish you all could have come here to Egypt so that I can look after you all, especially Mama in her current condition. That is not to say that I am not happy for the birth of Agatha, but I am worried about Mama. I would certainly like to come to the island of Syros and see you all, but my responsibilities have been mounting as I try to keep up with the new Al-Khediwe's plans for the country. Perhaps I can come next year and visit with all of you. Sincerely yours, Demetris. September 20th, 1855. Dear Demetris, I have terrible news. Mama has passed on. There was a funeral and many people attended, for she touched many lives with her kind heart. Love you, brother Ekaterini. New chapter. Title: The Suez Canal. Ahmed Rashid at age 38. Mohammed Said, the fourth son of Ahmed Ali Pasha, became the supreme ruler of Egypt and Sudan in 1854. He was educated in France. Al-Khediwe Said Pasha was a reformer and implemented new laws to stimulate the economy. He applied Western loans to modernization, Egyptian and Sudanese infrastructure. There were many changes to government officers, and replaced by officers more in tune to the progressive rule that he perused. However, Ahmed Pasha Rashid was considered a forward-looking minister of finance and was retained. In 1854, the first act of concession of land for the Suez Canal was granted to a French businessman, Ferdinand de Lesseps, The British opposed a Frenchman building the canal and persuaded the Ottoman Empire to deny its permission for 2 years. Construction of the canal started in 1859 with the naming of the city on the northern end, Port Said. In the same year, Al-Kedwe Said Pasha established the Bank of Egypt and built Egypt's first standard gauge railway called the Egyptian National Railways that was open for business between Kafr el-Zayat on the Rosetta branch of the Nile and Alexandria. Although the title of Pasha conferred a high status to its owner, Ahmed Pasha Rashid would still take a weekly bath in the public bathhouse near his home in El Ataba, Cairo, to visit with friends, relatives, and discuss all matters of politics. His close friend, Hussein el-Shabadi, invited him to go on the pilgrimage to Makkah that coming July. Ahmed Pasha Rashid had been thinking of making the pilgrimage that is required at least once in a Muslim's lifetime if they can afford it, and accepted the invitation. The pilgrimage lasts for 5 days starting in September 1st that year in Makkah, Saudi Arabia. From Cairo, the journey takes about 35 days to travel the 700 miles, so they had to leave on July 25th. He told Ubru Kemen and Misliar of his intentions and made preparations for them in his absence for 3 months. The government organized the journey's requirements as far as provisions for transportation, safety, and food for about 500 people. The transport was a large caravan of camels and donkeys escorted by soldiers of the crown. Frequent stops were made on the way at major cities such as Beni Suef, El Minya, Asut, and Sohag to purchase food and refresh the animals. The caravan headed south following the River Nile for about 300 miles to the city of Kina, where it bid farewell to the river and headed east through the eastern desert for about 100 miles, passing south of the mountain of Shayeb el-Banat, until it reached the port of Bir Safaga on the Red Sea. From there, sail ships were used to transport the pilgrims the last 300 miles to the port of Jeddah in the Saudi Arabia Peninsula. When Ahmed Pasha Rashid was about 6 miles from Makkah, he entered into a place designated for changing into the proper attire called a mikat. This signifies a state of holiness, known as ihram, that consisted of wearing 2 white seamless cloths, with the one wrapped around the waist, reaching below the knee, and the other draped over the left shoulder and tied at the right side, taking ablution. He declared the intention to perform the pilgrimage and to refrain from certain activities such as clipping the nails, shaving any part of the body, having sexual relations, using perfumes, damaging plants, killing animals, covering head, getting married, or carrying weapons. The ihram is meant to show equality of all pilgrims in front of God, emphasizing that there is no difference between the rich and the poor or race. He then headed to the Kaaba, which is located inside the Masjid Mosque, Al-Haram in Makkah City. There he performed tawaf, which involves walking 7 times counterclockwise around the Kaaba. Each circuit starts with the kissing or touching of the black stone. The first 3 circuits he did at a hurried pace, known as ramal, and the following 4 at a leisurely pace. Eating is not permitted during tawaf, but the drinking of water is allowed because of the risk of dehydration due to the often low humidity in Makkah. After completing tawaf, he made 2 rakat prayers at the place of Abraham, a site near Kaaba inside the mosque. He then drank water from the Zamzam well. Tawaf was followed by sa'i, which consisted of running and walking 7 times between the hills of Safa and Marwa, located near Kaaba. He then shaved his head, spent the night reciting the Quran, and sleeping under the open sky. On September 1st, Ahmed Pasha Rashid again donned the ihram garments and confirmed his intention to make the pilgrimage. After the morning prayer, he proceeded to Mina, where he spent the whole day praying the afternoon, evening, and night prayers. The next morning, September 2nd, after morning prayer, he left Mina for Arafat. He reached Arafat before noon, which is a barren and plain land some 20 kilometers east of Makkah, where he stood in contemplative vigil and offered supplications, repented on and atoned for his past sins, and sought the mercy of God, and listened to a sermon from an Islamic scholar who deliver it from near Jabal al-Rahma, the Mount of Mercy, from where Muhammad is said to have delivered his last sermon. This lasted from noon through sunset. At Masjid al-Namira, he offered noon and afternoon prayers together at noontime. He He then left Arafat for Muzdalifa after sunset without praying the evening prayer at Arafat. Muzdalifa is an area between Arafat and Mina. Upon reaching there, he performed evening and Isha prayer jointly, spent the night praying and sleeping on the ground with open sky, and gathered pebbles for the next day's ritual of the stoning of the devil. Back at Mina on the 3rd of September, he performed the symbolic stoning of the devil, Rimi al-Jamarat, by throwing 7 stones at only the largest of the 3 pillars, known as Jamrat al-Aqaba. These pillars are said to represent Satan. He then bought and slaughtered a sheep to commemorate the story of Abraham and Ismail. He then issued the meat to the poor. After the sacrifice, he shaved his head. On the same day, he revisited the Masjid al-Haram Mosque in Makkah for another tawaf, known as Tawaf al-Ifada. It symbolizes being in a hurry to respond to God and show love for Him. He then returned to Mina. At noon on the 4th and 5th days of September, he again threw 7 pebbles at each of the 3 pillars in Mina, symbolizing again the stoning of the devil. He then left Mina for Makkah. In Makkah, he circled the Kaaba 7 times counterclockwise, kissing it once. He then put on his regular clothes and traveled to the city of Medina to visit the Nabawi and Qiblatain mosques. He returned to Makkah the next day, and then to the port of Jeddah, where he returned to the port of Safaga in Egypt on a sail ship. There he reconnected with caravan that brought him there and waited a few days until all the pilgrims had returned to start the journey back to Cairo. In 1855, the first photographic studio opened for business in Cairo. Up to this point, portraits of leaders were commissioned paintings. Since the introduction of photography to Egypt, it became the rage of the upper class, and government buildings started to fill with their photos. However, Ahmed Pasha Rashid had a difficult time with sitting for any type of painting or photograph. One time he was persuaded by a colleague of his to have his photo taken. When it was his turn to take the seat in front of the cameraman tried to straighten his back and move it sideways, then twist his head towards the camera and position his arm this way and hand that way. When Ahmed Pasha Rashid burst out loud, "All this is not true to my character," and walked out of the studio. Nevertheless, a respectable portrait of Ahmed Pasha Rashid was made by an artist who knew him in order to cover up a blank spot on the finance ministry's wall, containing the portraits of past ministers. When the American Civil War brought a cotton famine, the export of Egyptian cotton surged during Saeed's rule to become the main source for European mills. At the behest of Napoleon III in 1863, Saeed dispatched part of a Sudanese battalion to help put down a rebellion against the Second Mexican Empire. Al-Qadiwe Saeed Pasha's heir presumptive, Ahmad Rifat, drowned in 1858 at Kafr el-Zayat, when a railway train on which he was traveling fell off a ferry into the Nile. Therefore, when Saeed died in January 1863, he was succeeded by his nephew Ismail. New chapter? Title: The House of Representatives, Agam, Ahmed Rashid, at age 47. After the death of Al-Qad Saeed Pasha, Al-Qadiwe Ismail Pasha was proclaimed supreme ruler of Egypt and the Sudan on January 19, 1863. He declared later, "My country is no longer in Africa. We are now part of Europe. It is therefore natural for us to abandon our former ways and to adopt a new system adapted to our social conditions." Al-Qadiwe Ismail Pasha launched vast schemes of internal reform on the scale of his grandfather, remodeling the customs system and the post office after those in Europe, stimulating commercial progress, creating a sugar industry, building palaces, entertaining lavishly, and maintaining an opera and a theater. He greatly expanded Cairo, building an entire new quarter of the city on its western edge modeled on Paris. Alexandria was also improved. He launched a vast railroad building project that saw Egypt and Sudan rise from having virtually none to the most railways per habitable kilometer of any nation in the world. Ahmed Pasha Rashid was invited to one of the lavish celebration events held by Al-Qadiwe Ismail Pasha at the Opera House. Ahmed Pasha was sitting balcony box next to Al-Qadiwe Ismail Pasha's. By that time, Ahmed Pasha Rashid was not working as Minister of Finance, for he was replaced when Al-Qadiwe Ismail Pasha took over the crown. La Traviata was the play, and before it started, Ahmed Pasha Rashid and Alkediwe Ismail Pasha exchanged glances. During the first intermission, Ahmed Pasha paid an usher 1 piastre to make a call on Alkediwe Ismail Pasha, requesting his permission for an audience with Ahmed Pasha Rashid. The usher came back with a grant to the request, but the second act had started, so Ahmed Pasha Rashid waited until the next intermission. "Good evening, Your Highness," said Ahmed Pasha as he bowed and tried to kiss, but missed when Alkediwe Ismail Pasha quickly yanked his hand away. "Good evening to you, Ahmed Pasha," replied Alkediwe Ismail Pasha. "What can I do for you?" "I have a suggestion in line with your progressive transformations, namely the formation of a House of Representatives as a new governmental body, much like that of the United States of America," said Ahmed Pasha Rashid. "I have been thinking along those lines, Ahmed Pasha, and I think it is a good idea, but who will to take this project on for me?" "I can, Your Highness. It would be a privilege and an honor to serve you in this capacity." "Very well, Ahmed Pasha. You must understand that this new body of government is to function only as an advisory board to me and nothing more." Ahmed Pasha Rashid wasted no time in organizing a group of experts to build the structure that would contain the House of Representatives and set up a commissioned board to oversee the first national election process. The building took 2 years to build. Then the elections process started and was completed in the third year. In November 1866, the first meeting of the assembly was held, and the first order of business was the election of an assembly speaker. After a week of fighting among themselves, Ahmed Pasha Rashid was elected by a unanimous vote to be the first speaker of the assembly, even though he was not an elected assemblyman. It was a surprise to him, and he agreed on the condition that he be the speaker for 3 months, after which an elected assemblyman be promoted to that position. Though this was supposed to be a purely advisory body, its members eventually came to have an important influence on governmental affairs. Village headmen dominated the assembly. They came to exert increasing political and economic influence over the countryside and the central government. This was shown in 1876, when the assembly persuaded Alkediwe Ismail Pasha to reinstate an old law that allowed land ownership and tax privileges to persons paying 6 years of land tax in advance. The Holy Lands were increasingly on his mind, and after the 3 months were over and a new Speaker of the House was elected, he simply put together a caravan and left Cairo on a pilgrimage to Makkah and Medina. When he arrived and completed the Hajj, he approached the city leaders of Makkah and proposed to them that he build a tikiya, a building that would house and feed for free the underprivileged who perform the Hajj. When they agreed, he went on to Medina and made the same proposal. The end result was that 2 tikiyas were built by him, one near the Kaaba in Makkah and the other in Medina. New chapter. Title: Shams Noor, Ahmed Rashid at age 51, of the small. She was 8 or 9 years old when he had seen her last. He did not know her name, only that they waved to each other from time to time from the second-story windows of their respective adjacent buildings. He kept seeing flashes of her face over and over again whenever he visited the Alexandria house. He had dreams of her sitting at her bedroom window, dropping her handkerchief, it floating in slow motion down to the street below, where he would catch it and try to deliver it to her, but never could. He thought things like, "Where is she now?" and "Is she married or not?" On April 15, 1867, his thoughts about her had a sense of urgency, and so he traveled to Alexandria on the train with his children, Ahmed and Farida. As he walked into Ahmed Aga's old house, he glanced at the adjacent building, thinking he would see her there. That evening, he climbed up the stairs to his old bedroom, opened the shutters, and looked at the window she used to sit at, but it was shuttered closed. He then pulled a chair, sat as he did as a young boy, looking at the traffic and pedestrians passing by below. An hour had passed by when he noticed that her window's shutters flew open, but then a feather duster appeared that was being shaken of its dust. Losing hope that he would ever see her again, he stood up and started to close the shutters when she appeared in her window, looking much as she did 38 years ago, but now looked about maybe 18 to 20 years old or so. He was exited, and he waved at her. She noticed him, but looked embarrassed and retreated from her window. "I must see her, speak with her," he said to himself, but how? To be subtle, he tried to send Usta Ahmed, the carriage driver's son, over to ask what the name of the family was that lived in the adjacent building. But the son already knew what it was. "It is Abdul Fatu, Pasha." Ahmed Pasha Rashid then asked if he knew the names of those in the family. "Yes, Pasha. The father was Ala el-Din Bey and his wife was Alsit Hibba. They passed away. May they rest on peace," answered Usta Ahmed's son. "Well, just don't stop there. What are the children's names?" "They had only one daughter, Pasha, and her name is Fatma." "Ah, her name is Fatma," Ahmed Pasha Rashid whispered to himself. "And who is Fatma married to?" Ahmed Pasha Rashid asked. "She's not married, Pasha," was the response. Ahmed Pasha Rashid didn't believe what he just heard. How can a beautiful woman like her not be married? He contemplated what to do next, for he wanted to meet her. He decided to invite her over to the house the next day to join him and his daughters in celebration of Bayram, so he arranged for a gift of flowers to be sent over to her house with an invitation. When Fatma walked in, he greeted her with his children on each side of him. He found her looking quite different than what he had seen in the window the day before. He was puzzled. Here was a woman who looks like she is 45 years of age and definitely not 20. He started to figure that it was probably a maid with the feather duster he had seen in the window. But she looked so like the girl in his dreams. As they sat at the lunch table, Ahmed Pasha Rashid tried to bring up the subject of children to her without looking like a meddler, so he started to talk about his children, especially his daughters, and how intelligent they were in their accomplishments. Fatma indicated that she had a daughter, Shams Noor, who is also gifted, whom she is also very proud of. "Why isn't she here with us?" asked Ahmed Pasha Rashid. "She is at home," responded Fatma. "I'm sorry, but I had intended for the invitation to include the whole family." "That is okay," answered Fatma. No, that is totally unacceptable. Farida, please go over and invite Shams Noor over to join us," insisted Ahmed Pasha Rashid. When Farida showed up with Shams Noor, Ahmed Pasha Rashid's fork fell out of his hand onto his plate, making a clink sound. She was the one in the window he saw the day before. He grabs his napkin to wipe his chin and stands up. He then greeted her by saying, "Welcome, Miss Shams Noor. Please sit down," and quick steps over to her and pulls a chair out from the table for her. "Yeah, Mohammed, please bring another setting for Miss Shams Noor," as he motioned for the waiter, Usta Mohammed. Shams Noor recognized Ahmed Pasha Rashid as being the old man who was waving to her from the window, and her eyes dropped to the floor in embarrassment before sitting. Everyone noticed Ahmed Pasha Rashid had a thing for Shams Noor as the afternoon progressed. From his glances to ordering this and that from Usta Mohammed, most realized that he was enamored by her. They also noticed how shy she was to the extra attention he was giving her. A couple of times, she tried to get up and leave, only to have her mother grasping her arm, keeping her put. "I wouldn't be surprised if Ahmed Pasha Rashid didn't ask for your hand in marriage," said Fatma to Shams Noor after they returned home. "Oh no, Mama, I don't want to marry an old man like that. I know you are attracted to Omar Shalabi, but he has no status, and it will be a struggle if you two join, that is if he ever has the courage to ask for your hand," said Fatma. "If I were you, I would accept Ahmed Pasha Rashid's request for your hand when it comes. I encourage you to try it out for a time in the engagement and then make the decision. After all, he is a wealthy Pasha who is more than able to take care of you and your children, God willing." Ahmed Pasha Rashid felt invigorated after Fatma accepted his request for Shams Noor's hand in marriage. He charmed Shams Noor into accepting him as her husband, and they were married 6 months later. She wanted to stay in Alexandria, so he bought her a grand villa in the heart of town. November 19, 1867. Dearest Ekaterini, greeting from Alexandria. I hope this letter find you all in good spirits and health. I have great news. I have married my fourth wife, Shams Noor. Her name means the light of the sun. She has just given me a daughter named Fatma after Shams Noor's mother. Shams Noor preferred to live in Alexandria, so I have bought her a villa in the heart of town. I will be traveling by train from Cairo to Alexandria once a month or so. It is now colder in Alexandria than in Cairo, and I fear for their safety and health. I wish you could be here and let me take care of your family. You can stay in close proximity to Shams Nur so that I can visit with all of you. Please give it some serious thought. Wishing you all the best. Demetrius, February 21, 1868. Dear Demetrius, hope you are doing well. Congratulations on your fourth wedding and sixth child, Fatma. I hope all of you are happy. We are doing well. Agatha is 12 years old now, and she is already saying she wants to join you in Egypt. I guess your wealth is a strong magnet to her. She dreams of having her own house and a horse-drawn carriage. Miltiadis, my husband, has retired and stays mostly at home, except for Tuesdays, when he takes a stroll to the Black Horse pub for a drink with his friends. Aglaia is getting married next month to Nicholas Lampros of Athena. They will be going back to Athena after the wedding. We will surely miss her around her. Tadaki has finished school, and his father is going to help him find a job as a bookkeeper. As for me, I have one wish, and that is to see you before too long. Love you, Ekaterini. New chapter. Title: Al-Khediwe Ismail's War. Ahmed Rashid at age 58. Al-Khediwe Ismail Pasha tried to extend Egypt's rule in Africa. In 1874, he annexed Darfur. He dreamt of expanding his realm across the entire Nile, including all its diverse sources, and over the whole African coast of the Red Sea. This, together with rumors about rich raw material and fertile soil, led Ismail Pasha to expansive policies directed against Ethiopia under the Emperor Johannes IV. In March 1876, Al-Khediwe Ismail Pasha's army suffered a dramatic defeat after an attack by Johannes's army at Gura. Ismail's son Hassan was captured by the Ethiopians and only released after a large ransom. This was followed by a long Cold War, only finishing in 1884 with the Anglo-Egyptian-Ethiopian-Hewitt Treaty. Al-Khediwe Ismail Pasha championed the building of the Suez Canal. He agreed to and oversaw the Egyptian portion of its construction. On his accession, he refused to ratify the concessions to the canal company made by Al-Khediwe Said Pasha, and the question was referred in 1864 to the arbitration of Napoleon III, who awarded £3,800,000 to the company as compensation for the losses they would incur by the changes which Al-Khediwe Ismail Pasha insisted upon in the original grant. These developments, especially the costly war with Ethiopia, left Egypt in deep debt to the European powers, and they used this position to wring concessions out of Al-Khediwe Ismail Pasha. One of the most unpopular among Egyptians and Sudanese was the new system of mixed courts, by which Europeans were tried by judges from their own states, rather than by Egyptian and Sudanese courts. But at length, the inevitable financial crisis came. A national debt of over £100 million from £3 million when he acceded to the throne had been incurred by him, whose fundamental idea of liquidating his borrowings was to borrow at increased interest. The bondholders became restive. Judgments were given against him in the international tribunals. When he could raise no more loans, he sold the Egyptian and Sudanese shares in the Suez Canal Company in 1875 to the British government for £3,976,582. This was immediately followed by the beginning of direct intervention by the great powers, culminating in both Great Britain and France controlling Egypt and Sudan. This control of the country was unacceptable to many Egyptians, who united behind a disaffected colonel named Ahmed Orabi. The Orabi revolt consumed Egypt. Hoping the revolt could relieve him of European control, Al-Khediwe Ismail Pasha did little to oppose Orabi and gave in to his demands to dissolve the government. Britain and France took the matter seriously and insisted in May 1879 on the reinstatement of the British and French ministers. With the country largely in the hands of Orabi, Al-Khediwe Ismail Pasha could not agree and had little interest in doing so. As a result, the British and French governments pressured the Ottoman Sultan Abdulhamid II to depose Al-Khediwe Ismail Pasha, and this was done on June 26, 1879. The more pliable Al-Khediwe Tufik Pasha, Ismail's eldest son, was made his successor. Al-Khediwe Ismail Pasha left Egypt and initially went into exile to Naples, but was eventually permitted by Sultan Abdulhamid II to retire to his palace of Emirgan on the Bosporus in Constantinople. There he remained, more or less a state prisoner, until his death. He was later buried in Cairo. July 24, 1879. Dear Demetrius, hope you are doing well. I have good and bad news to tell you. First, my dear Miltiades has passed on a month ago this Thursday. We had a small funeral for him where his brother and a few friends attended. He was buried next to father and mother. On the good side, Agatha is getting married in 3 months to Hadwin Papapandelides, who is a local merchant of specialty cloth made of Egyptian cotton. Not only have that, but they both want to go to Egypt, especially to live in Alexandria. They don't have the money to travel and set up in Alexandria now, but in a few years they hope to be able to afford it. In addition to the good news, Aglaé and Nicholas Lampros now have a child named Ekaterini, named after me, of all people. I hope to be able to visit them in Athena if that is possible. Aglaé says she has blue eyes. Love you, Ekaterini. October 9, 1879. Dear Ekaterini, I am sorry about the passing of Miltiades. He was a good man and he will be dearly missed by me. I am happy for Aglaé and Nicholas and little Ekaterini. I am going to have to make a special effort to see them all. Unfortunately, Egypt is having a few difficulties, and I can't at this time to leave. Perhaps I will be able to go to Athena when things settle down. I am so happy that Agatha and Hadwin will be coming to Alexandria. Please let them know that I will book their passage to Alexandria, and a grand house will be awaiting them when they arrive. Just let me know when they plan to come over. Best wishes, Demetrius. New chapter. Title: The Sohag Uprising. Ahmed Rashid at age 63. Al-Kadiwe Tawfiq Pasha was so displeased by the news of his accession to supreme ruler of Egypt and Sudan on June 26, 1879, that he soundly boxed the ears of the servant who first brought the tidings to him. Egypt and Sudan at that time were involved in financial and political troubles brought about by the policy of Ismail, and the situation was made worse by the inaction of Britain and France for some months following Al-Kadiwe Tawfiq Pasha's accession. Al-Kadiwe Tawfiq Pasha's people were dissatisfied, his army disaffected, his advisors were nearly all of the adventurer class, with their own ends to gain, and he himself had neither the character of a strong ruler nor the experience that would have enabled him to secure an orderly administration of affairs. Al-Kadiwe Tawfiq Pasha approached Ahmed Pasha Rashid to head the interior ministry. The two of them were boyhood friends during the summers in Alexandria, and so Ahmed Pasha Rashid agreed to take the job of interior minister, which was in charge of the country's police organizations. There was a religious uprising in the city of Sohag in Upper Egypt. The city was half Muslim, half Christian, and the dispute centered on the building a church at a central location in the city. One person was killed, which aggravated the situation, and Ahmed Pasha Rashid took it upon himself to intervene, since he owned a large portion of the city and surrounding land. When he arrived at the train station with 12 police officers from Cairo, the city was found to be in chaos, with rocks being thrown back and forth from the Christian community in the south and the Muslims in the north. There were blockades of several main streets preventing them from reaching the police station or the governor's office. The train station was in the north of town, where the tax department building was located, so they attempted to reach it by firing shots in the air to clear the streets as they proceeded through the Muslim neighborhood's side streets. Unfortunately, they became surrounded by peasants wielding clubs and other farm implements and could go no further. The head police officer suggested they shoot their way through the gathering crowds, but Ahmed Pasha Rashid objected, stating that these were his people. One person in the crowd advanced forward to Ahmed Pasha Rashid, who he recognized as the Amda, mayor of Sohag, who greeted him saying, "Salam alaikum, peace be upon you, Ahmed Pasha. Welcome to Sohag." Ahmed Pasha Rashid greeted Mayor Hussein and asked him what was going on. Mayor Hussein said that the Christians wanted to build a church in the middle of town, which was objected to since the country is a Muslim country and it just can't be done. It was then that they, the Christians, started to throw rocks at us. Ahmed Pasha Rashid then ordered the mayor to tell his followers to stop throwing rocks and put down their weapons, but the mayor would have none of that, asking him why they should. Ahmed Pasha Rashid tells him that someone needs to stop this mayhem and insisted that they do as he said immediately. The mayor then ordered his men to take away the police muskets. The police at first resisted, but then Ahmed Pasha Rashid told them to do as they say, and they did. Then Mayor Hussein told Ahmed Pasha and his police to follow him, and they did. Little did they know he was locking them up in one of the granaries. As the door closed and was locked from the outside, they could hear the muskets going off in the distance. Just then, Ahmed Pasha Rashid knew he had made a mistake in letting his police surrender their weapons to the mob. That evening, food was brought to the granary, and Ahmed Pasha Rashid inquired if anybody was hurt that day, and the messenger said that one Christian was killed and that two Muslims were hurt by the muskets. Apparently, the two Muslims were hurt by mishandling of the muskets. One put his hand over the muzzle when it went off, and the other was leaning on it when it went off. The rise-up continued into the next day, and by midday a casualty came into the granary. It was the mayor's son who was shot in the head while trying to load a musket. Ahmed Pasha Rashid requested a doctor for the boy, but nobody listened to him until the mayor arrived an hour later, rushing in demanding answers to what had happened to his son, but all were afraid to tell him except Ahmed Pasha Rashid. The mayor yelled for Dr. Yaqub to come and attend to his son, but he knew right off it was an impossibility since the doctor was a Christian fighting on the other side. Ahmed Pasha Rashid told the mayor that he would go over to the Christian side and return with the doctor only on one condition, and that was that the fighting would stop for the duration of his son's treatment. The mayor agreed to those conditions, and Ahmed Pasha Rashid was let out of the granary with a white flag as the mayor issued the command that all fighting stop on his side of town. Ahmed Pasha Rashid walked toward the Christian side of town, ducking the occasional rock thrown his way until he reached an overturned donkey cart with two fighters behind it. He greeted them and asked them to take him to their leader. As it turned out, the leader of the Christians was Dr. Yaqub, and as Ahmed Pasha Rashid explained what his mission was by coming there, did not impress the doctor. "Why should I care what happens to the mayor's son, especially when two of my people have been killed by those Muslim savages?" said the doctor. "We are all people of the Holy Book. You understand that, and so do they," said Ahmed Pasha Rashid. "But they will kill me as soon as I put foot in their territory," said the doctor. "On the contrary, the stakes are high because of the mayor's son's condition," said Ahmed Pasha. The doctor thought about the situation for a moment, then agreed to join Ahmed Pasha Rashid in walking back to the Muslim side to attend to the mayor's son. He issued the command for all his people to stop fighting, and with the white flag fluttering, they proceeded to the granary. As they entered the granary, they saw the mayor on his knees crying by his son's side. Apparently, his son had died. As any leverage, the doctor had disappeared. His face started to turn white with fear. His presence was useless now to the Muslims, and all he could think of was how to escape. Sensing the doctor's dilemma, Ahmed Pasha Rashid quickly pulled on the doctor's sleeve and motioned for him to kneel next to the boy and pray for his soul. As he did so, the mayor realized that the doctor was present and that he was offering his help in a way other than medicine. The mayor realized the doctor was taking a great risk by coming to his son's rescue, and he showed his appreciation by silently putting his arm around the doctor's shoulders. As the mayor's son was taken away to be dressed in white for the funeral, Ahmed Pasha Rashid approached both men, gave his condolences to the mayor, and then opened the subject of the cause to the unrest, namely the building of the church in the middle of town. This brought on grumbling by the mayor, who objected to that plan. "What I will propose is that I build a church and a mosque for you both outside of the proposed central location, and that the mosque be located in the north of town and the church in the south side of town." The doctor objected, saying that the Christian community had already bought the central location land on which to build their church. Ahmed Pasha Rashid offered to compensate the purchase price of the land. That seemed agreeable to the doctor after some thought. Once the agreement was reached, Ahmed Pasha Rashid proposed that hostilities end so that each side can bury their dead the next day. After the funerals, Ahmed Pasha Rashid returned to Cairo after locating and purchasing the land where the two holy places were to be built, and instructing the local masons to build the church and mosque according to the wishes of each faction. But disorder prevailed in Egypt as a whole until November 1879, when the dual control was re-established by the governments of Britain and France. The dissatisfaction culminated in the anti-foreign movement headed by Ahmed Orabi Pasha, who had gained complete command of the army. In July 1882, the attitude of Ahmed Orabi Pasha, who was carrying out defensive works on a large scale, made the British Admiral Sir Beauchamp Seymour declare that he would bombard the forts of Alexandria unless they were handed over to him. Before the bombardment began, it was suggested to Al-Khadiwe Tawfiq Pasha that he should leave the city and embark either upon a man-of-war belonging to one of the neutral powers or in his own yacht or in a mail steamer which was then in the port. His answer was, "I am still supreme leader of Egypt and Sudan. I will remain with my people in the hour of their danger." At his palace of Kasr el-Ramal, 3 miles from the town, he was beyond reach of the shells, but his life was nevertheless imperiled. When the rebel soldiers attacked the palace, he managed to make his escape and to reach another palace after passing through the burning streets of Alexandria. Here he was obliged to agree that a guard of British bluejackets protect him from further risk. The British landed in Alexandria and attempted to march on Cairo, but were defeated by Orabi Pasha's army at Kafr el-Dawar. The British then invaded from the east of the delta and managed to defeat Ahmed Orabi's army at Tel el-Kabir on September 13, 1882. He showed his courage equally during the cholera epidemic at Alexandria in 1883. When cholera broke out, he insisted upon going to Alexandria. His wife accompanied him, and he went round the hospitals, setting an excellent example to the authorities of the city and encouraging the patients by kind and hopeful words. February 8, 1883, Dear Ekaterini, I was in Cairo when I heard of Shams Noor's illness. I rushed to Alexandria to see her, but was too late, for she had succumbed to the dreaded cholera. I had no choice but to take our daughter, Fatma, back to Cairo with me, and she was taken in by my wife, Delbar, my third wife. The Alexandria villa was closed and shuttered, for I could not stomach selling it. We had too many wonderful memories together in it. On the other hand, Agatha, your daughter and family have not been touched by the epidemic, and on the contrary, she has had another baby named Stella, so now she has her hands full with Marika and Stella. She is a beautiful baby. They all live in an area called Romli, near the trolley station of Bakus, if you care to visit one day. Best wishes, Dimitris. In 1884, Sir Evelyn Baring went back to Egypt as diplomatic agent and consul general of Britain. His first task was to demand that Al-Khadiwe Tawfiq Pasha abandon the Sudan. Tawfiq gave his consent with natural reluctance, but, having consented, he did everything he could to ensure the success of the policy which Baring had been sent to carry out. Al-Khadiwe Tawfiq Pasha took a great interest in all matters connected with irrigation, education, and justice. He was not an imposing man, but he showed a genuine desire to govern his country for its own benefit. He understood the importance to Egypt of British assistance and support. His natural shrewdness made him accept the British conditions. His natural good feeling kept him from any inclination to intrigue. In private life, he was courteous and amiable. He had no desire to keep up the unapproachable state of an Oriental ruler. Indeed, in many ways, his manners and his habits were less Oriental than European. He married in 1873 his kinswoman, Emina Ilhami, with whom he lived. She was his only wife, and Al-Khadiwe Tawfiq Pasha was a strong advocate of monogamy. He died on the 7th of January 1892 at the Helwan Palace near Cairo, and was succeeded by his eldest son, Abbas II. New chapter. Title: The Last Hajj. Ahmed Rashid, at age 76, Al-Khadiwe Abbas II. Pasha was the last supreme ruler of Egypt and Sudan on January 8, 1892. At the outset of his reign, Al-Khadiwe Abbas II Pasha surrounded himself with a coterie of European advisors who opposed the British occupation of Egypt and Sudan and encouraged the young Khedive to challenge Cromer by replacing his ailing prime minister with an Egyptian nationalist. At Cromer's behest, Lord Rosebery, the British Foreign Secretary, sent Al-Khedive Abbas II Pasha a letter stating that he was obliged to consult the British consul on such issues as cabinet appointments. In January 1894, Al-Khedive Abbas II Pasha, while on an inspection tour of Egyptian army installations near the southern border, the Mahdists being at the time still in control of Sudan, made public remarks disparaging the Egyptian army units commanded by British officers. The British commander of the Egyptian army, Sir Herbert Kitchener, immediately offered to resign. Cromer strongly supported Kitchener and pressed him and the prime minister to retract his criticisms of the British officers. At 78 years of age, Ahmed Pasha Rashid decided to make one more visit to Makkah and perform his duty as an able pilgrim. The journey did not take the same route as before. He traveled to the city of Port Tawfiq at the southern end of the Suez Canal, where he got on board the vessel named the Abbasia, with a steam engine that headed to Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. This time, however, he was carrying a special gift to be presented to the Holy Kaaba. It was stored in a large crate and stowed in the hull of the ship. Instead of 35 days of travel, the trip to Jeddah lasted 5 days, and he arrived in Jeddah on June 5, 1894, 7 days before the start of the Hajj. He supervised the unloading of the crate containing the gift and arranged to have it transported to the Al-Haram Mosque, where he requested a meeting with the managing authorities and told that he can come the next day to meet them. He made arrangements to stay at a hostel for the next 3 days and have them store the crate. He then made it into town, found an eatery called Matam On, and sat down. The waiter introduced himself as Mohammed On, the owner of the establishment, and then asked what Ahmed Pasha Rashid would like to eat that evening, then rattled off a few items cooking that day. "If you would be so kind as to get me some water, for it is a hot day today," asked Ahmed Pasha Rashid, and the waiter turned his head and yelled, "Ya Habashiya, bring this gentleman some water." The words "Ya Habashiya" echoed in his head, for he had heard them before. A veiled dark-skinned woman approached him and poured him a cup of water from a jug she carried. He drank and paused, then asked for a refill of water. She did so, then left. Back at the hostel, he kept thinking of where he had heard those words before. Just as his eyes were shutting for the night, the burst open. He heard them when Ahmed Aga called for El-Habashiya in Kavala when he first met her. He was elated of the memory. The next day, he had the crate transported to the Al-Haram Mosque, met with the authorities, and explained to them that he brings a gift for the Kaaba. "We only accept gifts worthy of the Kaaba, dear Pasha," said the official. "My gift is a simple one. It contains no gold or silver, nor does it cost too much, but it is from my heart," said Ahmed Pasha Rashid. "Very well, please show us the gift," asked the official. The crate was opened, and there stood two candle holders made of glass in the shape of two trees, each with 18 hanging lanterns with candles intricately decorated with flowers. The official decided it was worthy of the Kaaba and accepted the gift. It was carried to the Kaaba, where the drapery was pulled aside and a door opened. The official then took the two candle holders in and returned a few minutes later, closing the door behind him. They then walked to a registry and registered it as gift number 344 and a brief description. That evening, Ahmed Pasha Rashid returned to the Matam On eatery. When the owner approached, Ahmed Pasha Rashid asked him if the waterwoman was his slave, and the owner said, "Yes, her name is Nargis Abdullah On. Why do you ask?" Ahmed Pasha Rashid replied, "I would like to purchase her from you." "No, she is too valuable to me here," answered the owner. "But I will make a generous offer of 1,000 piastres," responded Ahmed Pasha Rashid. The owner gasped but tried to hide it by coughing and then said, "I don't want to play games. I'll take 2,000 piastres. 1,450 Egyptian piastres is all I am ready to pay," said Ahmed Pasha Rashid, and the owner of the eatery agreed. After the Hajj, Nargis and he married in a simple ceremony in Makkah, but there was no simple way to break the news to Ubru Kiman, Misliar, and Delbar. They figured that she, Nargis, was a gold digger who captured his heart in a weak moment in the Holy Land. He denied all, but he could not reconcile with them. Narges bore him a son they named Hassan Ahmed Rashid, my grandfather, in 1896. She also convinced him to have his picture taken, only after promising he was not going to do any silly poses for the camera. Ahmed Pasha Rashid died in 1899 in his sleep. The gravesite in Cairo, Egypt, is in the old Cairo cemetery near the citadel, and is in a simple wooden building with an unassuming door and steel lock. When Narges died, she was put to rest just outside this wooden building, as was traditional when a slave was buried. Both his son Hassan Ahmed Rashid and his grandson Ahmed Adel Rashid, my father, are buried next to him inside this unmarked wooden structure. New chapter. Title: Epilogue. In 1941, a young officer in the Egyptian Air Force who had just graduated from medical school was summoned to the bedside of an old man suffering from an infected wound on the calf of his leg. "What is your name?" asked the officer, and the old man responded, "Khalaf El Nimr." "And how did you receive this wound?" "I was lying down under a tree and a donkey stepped on my leg." The young officer cleaned the wound and sprinkled it with a sulfur-containing drug, then wrapped the wounded leg with white gauze. "You need to rest until the wound heals, and most of all, stay away from donkeys." Khalaf laughed and asked, "And what is your name, sir?" "My name is Abdel Hamid Rashid." "Is your grandfather Ahmed Pasha Rashid?" And the officer responded in the affirmative. The old man got up and hobbled to a back room and returned holding a bag from which he produced three large porcelain spoons and said, "Please take these as payment for your tender service. They are leftover mementos from your grandfather's Hajj in 1892. The End. Copyright In Search of Identity. Copyright 2015 by Hassan A. Rashid, all rights reserved. No part of this book may be reproduced or transmitted in any form by any means, graphic, electronic, or mechanical, including photocopying, recording, taping, or by any information storage retrieval system, without the written permission of the author. Contact Globus 97402 at yahoo.com. ISBN 978-1-329-738-973.